Liberals started out being for freedom when there wasn't any. Being for freedom was liberal. Being conservative was for the power of the king. Remember? All of our founding fathers were liberals. Believe it. They were also traitors. So when somebody calls me a traitor because I'm supposedly against the government, it doesn't bother me. I'm in damn good company.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. That's Bristol Community FM Not. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. In the second part, the UN General Assembly on Zoom, would you believe, for its 75th anniversary. The West's mass media coverage for all but President Trump is virtually nil, but we hear from China and Russia, and of course, ubiquitous Mr. Trump tonight. Bit of a fly in the ointment at the General Assembly, I'm afraid. And the king of the Great Reset, is it Prince Charles or President of the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab? But they are also disdainers of the masses, puppets of the people behind the economic collapse. And a tribute to the Russian-born poet, journalist, philosopher and filmmaker Andrei Vilcek. Old and new, we hear him talk about a film he made for Venezuela's Telesur about the killing of Indonesia's culture after Henry Kissinger's 1970s coup. Sadly, Andrei died this week. Sorry, Martin?
1960s.
Was it in the 60s?
Right, sir.
Sorry about that. Okay, so, and also Andrei's final TV report, which was last week, about the fallout from the Belarus elections. And, as every week for the last month or so, David Livingston putting the jigsaw together that links British spy Jamal Afghani and the Islamic terror groups like the Salafists and, would you believe, the CIA's Operation Gladio, using Islamic terror and, actually before that, other sorts of terror against their own people, the CIA and NATO, killing domestic citizens in order to blame it on somebody, whether it be the Russians or the Islamists. All in one big black transatlantic Israeli operation from his book Black Terror, White Soldiers tonight. But I guess we should start, Martin, with this week. And we've had the quite amazing announcement from Rishi Sunak, who apparently, is, if you believe the polls, which I really do, is one of the most popular members of the government. He's saying that rather than actually struggle with a budget, he's going to cancel it.
Well, I mean, they're in a difficult position, let's face it. But, I mean, what he's done is, it under pressure, he's agreed. They said they were going to end the furlough scheme. But, of course, the Kurzarbeit in Germany is locked in for the next 2 years. He's going to extend it as furlough light for 6 months. But, of course, that just puts off the dreadful day when they've got to face the realities.
What's the Labour Party saying about all this? They just criticise. We're going to hear from him in a minute, but I mean, what are your thoughts? We're going to hear from Starmer on it.
I think they're pretty much saying, why aren't we doing what the Germans are doing? That's pretty much the line they're taking.
Steve Baker, I heard on the Peston, the unbearable Peston programme this week. Well, barely bearable. I think, you know, if you weren't doing a programme like this, you'd probably switch off after the first 5 minutes. But we have to sit through it. We have to sit through the gruelling programme. Steve Baker, the Conservative MP, was saying that he favours some sort of melding of the furlough scheme with universal credit, having basically what he was talking about was a universal basic income. So it seems that the Tories are considering that sort of thing, at least the backbench Tories now.
Well, I think the crisis has forced the issue on, you know, why do we do all the things we do, and what are we doing wrong, what are we doing right? And I think ultimately, if we'd had a universal income in place, not universal credit, of course, then we would have been in a much better position when we got into this situation, because everybody would have had an automatic handout from the government, which they'd have been getting anyway. And that provides a floor to the economy. And there's no point. You might as well have that in place rather than making it up as you go along when you hit the ice or the walls.
Also, the main news, I suppose, this week is the 6 month COVID measures. But just mentioned Steve Baker. He's the guy with probably the biggest. I don't know if anyone's actually got a ruler and measured it, but the biggest forehead in Parliament. Mm-hmm. It's just about, I think, about three times higher than the average forehead. Does that mean he's a more brainy guy?
I don't think it does, Tony, but I'm not going to enter into a discussion about
about his forehead. Why not? He's also saying he seems to be the sort of, I don't know, like Jeremy Corbyn was to Labour on the backbenches, Steve Baker to the seems to be to the Tories. He's now saying that Parliament should have power to block COVID measures. In other words, that once these measures have come through with no votes in Parliament from the government, which is this glorious, wonderful rule by edict that they're able to do since the Coronavirus Act was passed back in March, and is about to be renewed, I suppose that the government hopes that they will keep those powers. He's saying that the Parliament should be able to block all on any UK COVID measures they don't agree with.
Well, Parliament in theory is sovereign. And in theory, they're the ones who are supposed to decide, not the executive. So in principle, there's not much the matter with that. The problem being, of course, that you're then going to find that the Tory right, who will either force Johnson to do things he doesn't want to do, or they'll block what the rest of, you know, what everybody else wants to do. But I mean, that's an inevitable part of the process.
So this week, Steve Baker, Tory MP, asked Boris Johnson in the House of Commons to consider whether some innovative thinking can be applied to make sure the authority of this House is brought to bear on these measures in advance, so the public can have confidence that their representatives are authorising the use of law to constrain their freedom. So, I mean, there's no point really in writing to your Bristol MP or your MP, is there, if the government are just going to do what they want with none of this stuff being ratified by Parliament?
Well, that was the original position that Theresa May, if you remember, said about Brexit, that she wasn't going to go through Parliament, she was just going to do it herself.
Well, that's what they said, because that was a treaty, and government deals with treaties. Now, obviously, that it was such a big treaty, they decided they were going to debate it. But COVID is not a treaty, is it?
No, but on the other hand, if you've got to make a snap decision, for example, to call a lockdown in a particular town, have you got time to have a debate in Parliament?
So you're with Boris on this?
No, I'm just saying what the problem is about having...
So what would you do?
Well, I mean, the problem, this is a classic political problem. What should the relationship between the legislative and the executive be? And, of course, some systems are more executive-biased. In other words, you know, the government decides and the legislature basically just, you know, is a bit of a talking shop. And other places, it's the other way around. But, I mean, what we've got in this country is, in theory, Parliament is sovereign, but all power, in fact, is in the hands of the Prime Minister's office. And in this particular situation, it's actually in the hands of Dominic Cummings. He is deciding, Boris is then doing what he says, and everybody else has to jump.
So the beginning of the week was Patrick Vallance and Chris Whitty, both discussing the new measures for the next 6 months. They're saying neither of them were actually elected. But let's have a listen to what Patrick Vallance has to say. And he begins by talking about the large amounts of death that could be on the way very soon. But he always uses the word maybe. And this, of course, is the policy which the new COVID measures have been based on.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Patrick Vallance, the Government Chief Scientific Advisor, and I'm here with Chris Whitty, the Chief Medical Officer. In the ONS study, it's now estimated that roughly 70,000 people in the UK have COVID infection, and that about 6,000 people per day are getting the infection. So we are in a situation where numbers are clearly increasing. They're increasing across all age groups. It's a little bit different in different areas in terms of geographies, and Chris will speak to that. And this increase in numbers is also translating into an increase in hospitalisation, which Chris will say more about. So there's no doubt we are in a situation where the numbers are increasing. What I'd like to do is just remind you how quickly this can move. So the next slide is not a prediction, but it is a way of thinking about how quickly this can change. So this is the UK reported cases per day against time, and you can see running along the bottom there the number of cases over June, July and August, up to roughly 3,000 cases per day or so in September, middle of September. At the moment, we think that the epidemic is doubling roughly every 7 days. It could be a little bit longer, maybe a little bit shorter, but let's say roughly every 7 days. If And that's quite a big if, but if that continues unabated and this grows doubling every 7 days, then what you see, of course, let's say there were 5,000 today, it would be 10,000 next week, 20,000 the week after, 40,000 the week after. And you can see that by mid-October, if that continued, you would end up with something like 50,000 cases in the middle of October per day. 50,000 cases per day would be expected to lead a month later, so the middle of November, say, to 200 plus deaths per day. So this graph, which is not a prediction, is simply showing you how quickly this can move if the doubling time stays at 7 days.
Well, he's painting a pretty scary picture there, Martin, of the coronavirus about to take off and take over again. He's really predicting a second wave, which could be every bit as worse as the first.
Well, that's your interpretation of what he said, and I think it's probably fair. I mean, they're basically saying that we're going in the wrong direction, and as Boris Johnson famously said, a stitch in time saves nine.
So what do you mean by that?
Well, a stitch in time means if you stitch your clothes up before it gets going, then it's like the early lockdown. The early lockdown in New Zealand and China worked. But, of course, if you miss that early lockdown, you've then got the situation where you lock down and then you unlock down and then you've got to lock down again, which is what we're looking at.
Some smart aleck called Chris Kirk Blythe in one of the national papers pointed out this week in a letter, I said, Sir Patrick Vallance, the chief scientific advisor of the government, tells us the epidemic is doubling every 7 days, as we just heard. Thus, he calculates, frighteningly, that we will have 50,000 new infections a day by mid-October and 200 deaths a day a couple of weeks later, Martin.
Yeah, but as he said, it's not a prediction. It depends what happens. It depends what people do, doesn't it?
But isn't it the prediction in which the policy at the moment now is being based on?
Yes, and you can see tensions arising within the Tory party because Boris Johnson really smarting because he didn't lock down quick enough and also Cummings, more importantly, fearing that they're going to take the blame if there's a second spike. So they're pushing for more lockdown measures. Meanwhile, Rishi Sunak and the right of the party are manoeuvring against that. So we're then going to have the government fighting like rats in a sack over which way to go. Meanwhile, the country drifts towards, whatever it's drifting towards.
Which is?
Well, a second spike and a no-deal Brexit in January.
Oh, always the doom and gloom, Merchant Martin. Anyway, I thought I'd just finish the letter, which was written to the... I'm not sure which paper it was, and I'll share it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk by Chris Kirk Blythe. And he says, applying the same method, the entire population will have had COVID-19 and 11.5 million of us will be dead before Christmas Day. Shortly after New Year's Day, all human life in the UK will have ended. Merry Christmas, everyone, he says. So that's just carrying on with the prediction that Patrick Vallance is making there.
Well, what would happen if he really get a second spike is no matter what the government says, people are going to lock themselves down. And that's what used to happen in the Middle Ages, you know. We didn't have mass communications. People just freaked out, panicked, ran away and hid.
But he's pointing out, basically, that it's an absurd prediction and it's rather like Neil Ferguson Take Two. Remember that guy that got everyone to lock down but wouldn't lock down himself and then got sacked and was paid by the Gates Organization?
Well, there is now big dispute between the different authorities about what's happening, what we should do.
So what would you do?
Well, I basically listen to what everybody is saying. I think we should have locked down from the get-go, but we didn't do it. New Zealand did, China
so
did,
when was
and
the
they're ahead.
When was the get-go in your interpretation, Dr. Summers?
The get-go was when the Chinese started taking it seriously, and of course, because they took it seriously...
That was the end of last year. And
don't forget, the defence...
But it wasn't here, supposedly.
No, yes, but it was coming. We should have seen it.
But it was here.
Yes, it was here.
It was here.
Yeah, indeed. Don't forget, the Defence Intelligence Agency of the United States, I say this week after week, told the Israeli Defence Forces in November last year that there was going to be a pandemic coming out of China. How did they know that? Very interesting to find out, wouldn't it? And, of course, in September, the financial markets collapsed And then this came along, which gives them an excuse to bail
anyway,
them out.
Anyway, going back to Patrick Vallance and his amazing prediction there.
It's not a prediction. He said it wasn't.
He said it wasn't, but it was. And it was a prediction that the government have based their policy on to lock down. Well, it's not a lockdown,
no,
but to restrict measures for the next 6 months.
Yeah.
And in the Daily Mail, which is a newspaper I know you read avidly, Martin, it says, revealed
the
doomsday prediction of 50,000 cases a day in October is based on just a few hundred positive cases, as Oxford experts warns the UK risks taking ourselves back into a lockdown. Patrick Vallance and Chris Whitty told the UK it could be as many as 50,000 daily cases by mid-October, but the medical officer based his outlandish, in inverted commas, figure on population studies. These multiplied just a few hundred cases of coronavirus to estimate infections doubling every week. Claims by the studies are not supported by government testing data, which suggests doubling every 2 weeks. So he's not really levelling with us, is he?
Well, he's saying it's every 7 days, and there's other chaps saying it's every 2 weeks.
Is it part of his job to exaggerate things? So he's, in case there's a worst-case scenario, he's not caught on the hop?
Well, different countries have different systems for working out what they're going to say and how they're going to approach it.
But isn't that what's going on here? He's actually, potentially anyway, exaggerating the claims, because the last thing he wants is to be have the finger pointed at him saying, well, this has been this massive disaster and it's all your fault, Patrick Vallance.
Well, it may well be so, but the fact is that there's all sorts of pressures on him and on ministers and on us as individuals. And, you know, what's obviously clear is that the political systems of every country are being tested to the limit.
Well,
and some political systems are working, like in communist China, and some political systems, like in Tory-run Britain, are not.
Well, one of the reasons that might be, and one of the pressures that might be on Sir Patrick Vallance, the Daily Telegraph revealed that he's got £600,000, a very nice figure if you could manage to save that amount up, invested in the firm which he's contracted to develop the vaccines. Government denies claims of potential conflict of interest, maintaining he is not involved in commercial decisions on the coronavirus vaccines. That was by Charles Hymas in the Telegraph this week, Martin. UK's chief scientific advisor has a £600,000 shareholding in drug giant contracted to develop the COVID-19 vaccine for the government, prompting claims of a potential conflict of interest. So not only could he be trying to cover himself in terms of not making a prediction when things go disastrously wrong, he could also be just simply trying to feather his own nest and put money in his own pocket.
Well, you'd have thought that if he got money to be made from a vaccine, he'd be in quite keen for it to spread. But I think also, of course, what Putin said in the UN this week is he's going to offer the Sputnik 5 vaccine for free to everybody. So that should undercut Gates, shouldn't it?
So will that be available to Sir Patrick Vallance, I wonder?
Well, it's up to the British government. What the US government have put in sanctions,
Martin,
on the Russian laboratory which has developed it, because they're claiming they're developing biological and chemical weapons.
But Patrick Vallance has got a massive vested interest in talking up the problem, hasn't it? And because that means that there will have to be a vaccine. If there's still COVID-19 is still hanging around Christmas next year, everyone's dying at Christmas, then the vaccine companies are going to be making a fortune, because everyone will be looking to them to help everyone get rid of the virus, which others will say has disappeared already.
Well, I mean, you can question whether Patrick Vallance should be in his position. The fact is he is in position.
He shouldn't take any role in this,
no.
Surely, by basic probity. If he's got over £500,000 of his personal money invested in a vaccine company, I think it's GlaxoSmithKline in this case, then surely you should take no part in decisions.
Well, I would argue that anybody who's working in the civil service or in politics shouldn't have any other business interests at all. So in that case, on that count, if he was going to be the chief medical officer, he should be the chief medical officer and live on the money he's paid. All the moaning from Boris Johnson this week, he can't live on 150 grand. He can't afford a nanny. How terrible.
Oh, well, back to the virus. The BBC, Rachel Schreier at the BBC, the health reporter, is reporting that tests could be picking up a dead virus. And the main test used to diagnose coronavirus is so sensitive it could be picking up fragments of dead virus from old infections, scientists say. Researchers say it could be leading to an overestimate of the current scale of the pandemic. Professor Carl Hengehan one of the study's authors said instead of giving a yes-no result based on whether any virus is detected, tests should have a cut-off point so that very small amounts of virus do not trigger a positive result. He believes the detection of traces of dead virus will partly explain why the number of cases is rising. So this PCR test is detecting little strands of DNA, of bits of virus, Martin, that our bodies have already killed off, and yet it's still a positive test.
Well, I think it's pretty obvious that in March, when there was no test and trace in place to all intents and purposes, we had, basically the people who were diagnosed with COVID were people who were turning up in hospitals and so on. We've now got a sort of test and trace system in place, so we're now finding more people with the virus. You can see there's, the statistics are bound to be skewed in that way. Now, we could argue about all of this, but ultimately, the population and the government have to decide. We've appointed this guy, Valance and Whitty, to tell us what to do. Are we going to listen to them or are we going to ignore them?
Well, let's listen to them again. And I was listening to Talk Radio on Monday as they were doing their speeches live about the virus. And I was quite amazed to hear that the presenter couldn't bear to listen to it anymore. He thought it was such a load of rubbish that he switched it off about three quarters of the way through and said, look, I've heard enough. That's nonsense and that's nonsense. So let's just have a listen to that moment now. I don't know whether that's a good thing for journalists to do. Certainly BBC Five Live's Emma Barnett, I know she tunes out usually about two-thirds or three-quarters of the way through Prime Minister's questions. So I suppose that it's okay to do that on talk radio. But let's have a listen now to Chris Whitty, who's then interrupted by... And Chris Whitty, by the way, is the Chief Medical Advisor, interrupted by Mike Graham on talk radio.
There are, as we've said from the beginning, and it really does need to be repeated, four ways in which this virus is going to have a very potential significant effect on the population's health if we let it go out of control. The first, the easiest to identify, is direct COVID deaths, people who get the virus and die of the virus. The second would be if the NHS emergency services were overwhelmed by a huge spike, and that is what the extraordinary efforts of the population allowed to prevent happening in the first wave we met. The third, however, is very important, and I think its importance should not be understated, which is if the NHS is having to spend a large proportion of its effort in trying to treat COVID cases, because the numbers have gone up very high, to very high levels, and trying to put in place large numbers of systems to try and reduce the risk of transmission in hospitals, it will lead to a reduction in treatment for other areas, in early diagnosis of disease, and in prevention programs.
I'm sorry, Chris Whitty. I just can't listen to much more of this. I'm going to have to interrupt it. Peter Hitchens is here with me. Peter, I can barely believe my ears with this stuff. We've already had an NHS which doesn't treat anything else because of the COVID scare, which never happened. Now they're telling us we're going to have another one.
Well, let's not say it never happened. It was obviously something that did go seriously wrong, and a lot of it went wrong, as we now know, in the care homes, which is something which we could quite possibly do something quite useful about preventing again. What is startling about is the presentation of figures entirely without scepticism or rational analysis. You talk for instance, the figures for cases. It is not made clear that most of these cases are asymptomatic, and most of the people who are supposedly detected as having had COVID are perfectly well. An absurd assertion is made that the number of cases has not risen because the amount of testing has risen. Which is quite obvious to anyone. The simplest intelligence cannot be true. If you test hundreds of thousands of people a week, you will find more cases. Also, it doesn't seem to dwell at all upon the major problem, which everybody involved in this is well aware of false positives going people who are positive who actually aren't. And then the other thing which nobody is mentioning is that on September the 30th, a mere 9 days away, Parliament has to vote on the renewal of the extremely potent measures of the coronavirus bill. And it seems to me that this whole ramping up of figures into the appearance of a huge second wave when nothing kind of set in place has much more to do with the political needs of the government and its desire to scare members of parliament into accepting yet again legislation they ought never to have allowed to go through is really what's going on.
So that's Peter Hitchens. For me, very much nailing it there, Martin, saying that actually there's this very important vote coming along next week. The idea is, with what Whitty's saying, is to really to scare politicians, MPs, etc., with a rather similar situation to what we had in March. The idea is that that's going to happen all again. But he's also pointing out, isn't he, that the evidence is not being provided for these decisions. But anyway, what do you think? Do you think it's possible that the government actually is talking this up because they've got a vote next week and they want to get it through?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, there are now tensions in the cabinet between Cummings and Johnson, who are on the side of Whitty in terms of talking it up, and people like Sunak, because he's now manoeuvring to replace Johnson, who wants basically feel that this is all a scaremongering tactic to keep Johnson and Cummings in power. So we're going to see, as I say, fighting like rats in a sack over this. And as you say earlier, I mean, that's talk radio, they can do what they like. But I mean, proper journalism would allow him to finish what he's saying, however stupid, and then critique it. But never mind, they can say what they want. Well, and I can say what I want, which is, why didn't we hear all of it?
Well, I can tell you, possibly one of the reasons you didn't hear all of it is because that they've only got a certain amount of time that Peter Hitchens is contracted to talk, and that they've got if they let him talk and talk balance, then Peter Hitchens won't be able to say anything.
Okay, but on the other hand, you're going to find people who are going to say, well, hang on a minute, we didn't even hear what he had to say before you jumped in. And, of course, Peter Hitchens' qualifications are... I mean, Peter Hitchens obviously a very sane sort of a chap and probably got a university degree like his brother and all the rest of it, but he's not anybody that's got any qualifications in this. That's just his opinion.
Yes, and it's an extremely powerful opinion, isn't it? Because he's saying, quite rightly, that the asymptomatic cases were not even mentioned by these scientific, so-called scientific and medical people.
But surely the problem with it, if it's a biological warfare weapon, Tony, is that the asymptomatic cases is how it spreads. And that's the problem. They thought there were no asymptomatic cases to begin with, and that's why they didn't probably bother chasing people down who were asymptomatic.
Well, they didn't even mention them. This is the
that's
point.
That's because they didn't know.
The point that Peter Hitchens is making stands, doesn't it? They should be mentioning the fact that so many of these people are not actually even ill.
No, they're saying they are COVID. They've got COVID, which they can then pass to other people. That's the whole point
well,
of it, isn't
not,
it?
Not if it's dead.
No, if they've got a COVID positive COVID test, they can pass it on to other people.
No, they can't. That's nonsense, because many of these COVID tests, it's now absolutely clear, are testing for a dead virus, which can't be passed on to anybody.
Various people have said that there are false positives, but that we don't actually know how many false positives there are. And, of course, the whole idea that asymptomatic people don't matter.
In which case,
that's absurd. Asymptomatic people can pass it to others.
In which case, Valance and Whitty should be mentioning that, shouldn't they? And that's Peter Hitchens' point. He doesn't need to be medically qualified to point that out.
No, he doesn't. And people are obviously listening to Peter Hitchens. He gets paid a good whack for his opinions about all sorts of things. But people can make their own minds up whether they agree with him.
He's saying these opinions for money.
Of course he is. He's paid to sit on just.
But he's only saying them because he's only being saying them because he's being paid.
No. But Peter Hitchens is a paid controversialist. Yeah,
and he's only saying it to be controversial.
Like his
Martin,
brother.
He's making important points. He's saying two things there. One is that they're not talking about whether these people are asymptomatic, whether they're actually sick or not. And the other thing is that there are an enormous number, he says, and there's lots of evidence for it, of false positives, and these government people are not talking about that at all. You don't need to be a genius or paid to say those things.
Okay.
They're very good points.
Well, let's just come back to the two points you've made. The question of whether there are false positives is still not resolved one way or the other. It may be so, it may not.
We'll be resolving it in a minute,
okay,
I hope.
Let's just put that on one side. The idea that people who are asymptomatic, it doesn't matter. Asymptomatic people are the most dangerous people of all. Super spreaders, they call them. You remember? They go to a party, they're the one, they're not showing any symptoms at all, they dance with everybody, they're drinking, having a great time, and they pass it to everybody else.
And maybe it's
else.
Because they've got a false positive and they're not spreading anything.
Well, but they showed a wedding. I read about a wedding in the US where 175 people went. There was one super spreader there. Virtually everybody in the wedding got it. Seven people died, none of whom had attended the wedding. Okay? And that's in countries where they've got some kind of tracing going on.
Was there any children? Did they die as well?
Because
they had quite a lot of stories about children dying.
All right, Tony.
But actually, it turned out they were all untrue.
All right, Tony. You've got an agenda here, and
I'm just arguing with you, Martin. That's what we do every week.
Yes, indeed. And I don't intend to enter into a major argument about who's spreading what here. I'm just trying to, you know, everybody's just got to keep their wits about them
quite right
and listen to what people are saying.
It's quite right of you to say we should have more from the so-called pro-lockdown scientists, and these people right at the top, the heart of government, are some of the main ones. And so I'm sure you're happy that we've heard more and more from them. There's a bit more now as well from Patrick Vallance again. This, I think, is the bit which we had Peter Hitchens and Mike Graham on Talk Radio talking over. So I'm sure you'll be happy to hear we'll be hearing a bit of that now. And this is about the vaccine.
We will be living with this virus. This is now circulating amongst the population worldwide. It will continue to do so. We will be learning how to live with it. One important part of that is vaccines. I'm pleased to say that there is good progress that's been made. Many vaccines now have shown they generate an immune response of a type that ought to be protective. And several vaccines are in very late stage clinical testing, aiming to show that they are both effective and safe. The UK, through the Vaccines Task Force, has got access to a number of these, as illustrated on this slide, with a range of different vaccine technologies from a number of different companies. The UK, therefore, has put itself in a good position in terms of vaccine supply and the possibility that one of these will work. We don't yet know that they will work, but there is increasing evidence that it's pointed in the right direction, and it's possible that some vaccine could be available before the end of the year in small amounts for certain groups. Much more likely that we'll see vaccines becoming available over the first half of next year. Again, not certain, but pointed in the right direction, which then, of course, gives the possibility of a different approach to this virus. But in the meantime, we've got to get on control of this in the way that Chris has described, in order to make sure that we can live with it in a way that's sustainable and protects health and society overall. Thank you very much.
So that's Sir Patrick Vallance again. Controlling the virus, is it really possible to control a virus? I mean, we heard, didn't we, about King Canute making the point hundreds of years ago, a thousand or so years ago, that you can't control everything, however much the government or royalty or whoever wants to control it. Sometimes a virus is just going to spread.
Yeah, unlike in communist China, where they've got less than 5,000 deaths now.
It's spread there too.
It's not spreading now.
It's not spread as much, but it's spread there too, didn't it?
Yeah, because
all over the place in Wuhan.
Yeah, and then they locked Wuhan down and tested everybody, and now it's not spreading in China at all. And as we go into the face-off, because if this is a biological weapon, this is to do with World War III, Tony, a face-off between the Chinese military and the Western military and the collapse of the banking system, the Chinese are well-placed. So their economy is bouncing back.
Do you think Patrick Vallance is unbiased there when he's talking about this glorious vaccine that's going to come like a knight in shining armour over the horizon and save us all?
Well, as I said earlier, the Russians have already developed the Sputnik 5 vaccine, which they're already testing.
Cabinet Minister denied there was a conflict of interest. So Health Secretary Matt Hancock said he found out from a newspaper, must be the Telegraph, I'm sure he's a Telegraph man, about UK Chief Scientific Advisor Patrick Vallance's shares in a drug company contracted to develop a coronavirus vaccine. The Cabinet Minister denied there was any conflict of interest, who leads the government's expert advisory panel on vaccines. He holds shares worth £600,000 in GlaxoSmithKline, a deferred bonus of 43,111 shares in the British multinational outfit when he was president of GlaxoSmithKline. Now, this is one hell of a revolving door, isn't it?
It is.
It's a former boss of GlaxoSmithKline now telling us, you know, we've got to all lock down because there's a virus. A vaccine is good. Only a vaccine can save us. His vaccine.
Yeah, except that the Russians have already got a vaccine and they're offering it for nothing, even though
conflict of interest here, Martin? Can you just focus on this is the third time you've talked about this Russian vaccine.
Yeah, because...
Fine, but can you focus on this conflict of interest here? This is absolutely shocking to me that somebody as a former president of Glaxo is telling us we've all got to lock down and wait for his vaccine.
Yes, there are massive conflicts of interest in the way healthcare is run in the West. But of course, in communist China, they don't run it like that. And in Cuba, they don't run it like that.
It's not a very good health secretary, Mac Hancock, if he didn't even know that this guy had shares in Glaxo,
well,
is he, really?
Well, in actual fact, we ought to know all of the interests of all of the people that are speaking to us in politics and in the civil service. If civil servants, in my view, should not have any kind of outside interests. And the same ought to be true of politicians. When you're paid 150 grand to be the prime minister, that should be your salary. But of course, we know that Boris gets lots of money on the side from doing all sorts of other
stuff.
Partly
the problem here is this old revolving door, isn't it? That policy is being made by top civil servants who are straight out of the same industry. In a way...
No, the top civil servants used to be separated off from industry. But of course, the public-private partnership merry-go-round that's been set up since Thatcher came to power means that we're bringing people in from industry to work in the civil service all the time. There used to be, if you were a top civil servant, your reward was ultimately a gong, and you weren't allowed to work for private enterprise at all, and that was actually the right policy.
So we were talking just now about this whole thing of false positives. One of the top virologists is now retired from a company called Pfizer, you know, one of these big vaccine firms. They're working on vaccines right now. His name is Dr. Mike Yeadon. He has a lot of serious doubts, and in fact he's written an article which I'll put a link up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk all about this, talking about lies, damn lies and government statistics this week after he heard this speech by Patrick Vallance. So let's have a listen now to him. Here he is again, this time he is talking about this whole thing of false positives. Now, he's somebody who's worked right in the middle of this industry in the labs, and he's now retired, so he's free to speak his mind. Dr. Mike Yeadon.
The evidence to date, I think, suggests that all or a substantial part of these positives could be due to what's called false positive tests. Now, government knows that the PCR test is very sensitive, and all tests have a propensity to throw up a particular false positive rate. What's really frustrating, Julie, and your listeners should know this, the government doesn't know what the false positive rate is, or if it does, it's not declaring it and continuing with the assumption that it's zero. And it's definitely not zero. And Carl Hennigan did a calculation, and he showed that if the false positive rate is as little as 0.1%, then more than half the positive tests are in fact false or fake. And I think the false positive rate is probably much higher, possibly 1%. And if that's true, most or all of the positives are actually false, and they are not infected, infectious or ill.
And the key thing there is, of course, I mean, again, for those of us who are not medically trained or scientifically trained, or indeed a great math nerds either, it's because the actual percentage of people who are being tested positive is a tiny, tiny percentage. So if you have a false positive rate at that level, you actually are accounting for effectively all of the positive test results.
We know that, because it's been shown, that people who've recovered from the virus and they're clinically well, and you can no longer culture virus from a sample from their mouth or airways, still can be positive in the PCR test. And that's because, as you say, the test is not a test for virus. It's not a test for living virus. The test looks for a particular piece of the genetic code. And if it finds a small piece of a dead virus that's still stuck in your mucus and is being shed from cells, you could still be positive on a swab test for a long time. So that's what I think is a significant contribution. And the other one is just intrinsically that tests occasionally, statistically, throw up false positives. And as you say, a very good point, Julia, that the ONS survey still says that the prevalence of the virus is very low, which is good, less than 0.1%. So if we find 2% positives and yet no one's ill, I'm worried that specifically Matt Hancock's pillar two test is flawed.
That's community testing. That's people who are going to school, going to work and getting tested. Yeah.
Yes. And I think, did you see on the TV the other day, they showed a little clip of people beavering away on a line of white tables, looked like big picnic tables, and they were in something that, for all the world, looked like a marquee tent. Mm-hmm. And there were some, you know, people casting around, wearing gloves and so on. I think if they're really doing the tests or processing the samples there, you've got to be kidding. Imagine this was a test in a forensic case in law, because this is the same kind of thing. They use PCR to try and prove you are or are not the guilty party. But if you were doing your forensic work in a tent like that, the lawyer would just throw it out and say, don't believe it.
So that's Dr. Michael Yeadon there, Martin, making a pretty strong case. And his article has been circulating online, lies, damn lies and government statistics. Now, he's making the assertion there as someone that used to work for Pfizer on their vaccines and in investigating viruses for them, that almost all the tests, and what he's saying basically is all the people who are asymptomatic might possibly be producing false positives.
Well, I hear what he says. I've not heard anything about false negatives here. Maybe there could be false negatives, Tony. Have you thought of that? People who are tested and are actually infected.
Well, are you going to actually answer the point? Up. Or are we going to talk about something different?
Well, no, because I cannot answer the point. He's a doctor. And if he's right, he's right. Other doctors say, no, I don't think he's right about this.
So these are matters of fact. We could be making these big decisions based on something which is just basically bad science. So they're finding little bits of dead vaccine in people. Sorry, little bits of dead virus in people, and saying, "Oh well, you're infectious," when actually people aren't. So there is obviously, again, we're going back to Patrick Vallance and his former president of GlaxoSmithKline being in charge of this policy. I mean, really, Boris has completely lost control, hasn't he? The big pharma are completely in charge of policy with someone like Vallance in charge here.
Big pharma are very much in charge of a lot of things, just as big finance are and big military. That just goes without saying, Tony, doesn't it?
No, not necessarily, because some governments push back more than others, and this one doesn't seem to be pushing back against big pharma hardly at all.
No, because they're a Tory government, and they wouldn't, would they?
So would a Labour government? Because actually, Keir Starmer is pushing more for more of a lockdown. He doesn't think that there should be...
Nicola Sturgeon is.
Like a
Nicola Sturgeon has banned people from going to each other's houses. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out, because England and Scotland are now playing different strategies.
Well,
in a few weeks' time, we'll see which one was right, won't we?
We certainly will. And we found out there were different strategies right from the start, actually, around the world. And some of the countries that came out very well, like Sweden, Britain has come out very, very badly in comparison. So, you know, us jumping... actually, after the horse had bolted, we shut the stable door, didn't we? I mean, if you believe much of the evidence there, the COVID-19 was probably circulating in Bristol and around the southwest in December last year. For us to try and lock down in March, once people realised that this could be actually quite a nasty virus, was way too late.
Yeah, it was way too late. And interestingly enough, the Chinese, where the virus supposedly...
you weren't calling for a lockdown in December, Martin, were you?
I'm not a doctor,
no,
it's not me in charge.
No, but you're saying that we should have been locking down straight away. You didn't even know the thing was around in December. Nobody did.
Nobody knew, apart from the Defence Intelligence Agency of the United States, who told the Israeli Defence Forces in November that a pandemic was coming out of China.
Yeah, but you didn't have their crystal ball, did you?
No, well, their crystal ball is probably because they were involved in creating it because of the collapse in the stock market
in September.
So do you think
Boris should have locked down? Did he have a crystal ball?
No, and nor did Donald Trump.
In December?
No, nor did Donald Trump. And of course, if it's a deep state biological warfare attack geared to the financial markets, you can be damn sure that neither Boris Johnson nor Donald Trump will know anything about it. It's actually, you know, they are just basically front men. Isn't that obvious?
Quite possibly. Okay, so let's have a listen now to Keir Starmer at Prime Minister's Questions, where he took Boris on. We're going to hear a bit more from Starmer this week, because they had the Zoom, just like we had a Zoom United Nations, we had a Zoom Labour Party conference this week, which was, I found rather absurd to watch bits of that. I mean, I don't know how people could actually survive through it. Did you watch it, Martin?
No, I was at work, Tony.
Okay, so let's have a listen now to the... Oh, you didn't watch it after work, no?
No, you're I didn't. Surprisingly enough, I didn't put it on.
You're
after
an
work.
Enthusiastic Labour Party member. Surely you would want to watch your great leader, even if he is on Zoom.
No? Well, no. I read about what he says.
Okay,
fair
enough.
I don't actually watch much TV.
Let's have a listen to him now at Prime Minister's Questions this week, taking Boris on the COVID.
Keir Starmer.
Mr. Speaker, I'm not asking about the support that was being put in place in the past. We support that. I'm asking about the support that's needed now, particularly in light of the restrictions announced yesterday. Mr. Speaker, this is not theoretical. Yesterday, 6,000 jobs were lost at Whitbread, one of the major employers in the hospitality sector. The CBI, the TUC and trade unions, the Federation of Small Businesses, the British Chamber of Commerce, the Governor of the Bank of England, they're all calling on the Prime Minister to stop and rethink. Support the businesses affected. Don't withdraw furlough. We've been saying it for months. When is the Prime Minister finally going to act?
Mr Speaker, these are indeed tough times, and I have no doubt that many businesses, many employees are feeling a great deal of anxiety and uncertainty, and we will do our level best to protect them throughout this period. But we will get through this, Mr Speaker, by precisely the methods that we have outlined and that were agreed upon in this House yesterday. And I may say, I think that the reality of the opposition position has been exposed. The cat's out of the bag, Mr Speaker, because it was his shadow education secretary who said of the present crisis, she said, don't let a good crisis go to waste. That's the real approach of the Labour Party, Mr Speaker, seeking to create political opportunity out of a crisis, out of the difficulties and dangers this country is going through, whilst we are taking the tough decisions. The tough decisions to get this virus down, Mr Speaker, to keep our education system going and to keep our economy moving. He supported it yesterday. I hope he will, in a spirit of togetherness and unity, that he will continue to give it his support.
So that's Boris replying to Keir Starmer, sort of pushing on the economic side of things and whether there's going to be support for people who are losing their jobs. I don't think there really is much, Martin. It's all petering out now, isn't it?
It is, but of course Sunak has basically decided that he isn't going to completely cut people off. I was reading stuff today that the way he's finessed it, it's going to be cheaper for employers to keep one employee on and sack everybody else, rather than keep several employees on and pay their wages, some of their wages. So it's not very well designed. Of course, in Germany, they've got the Kurzarbeit, which basically supports short-time working. And they've had that for years. They brought it in 2008, and it actually goes back, you know, decades in Germany. And, as always, they're better organised than we are. And they pretty much know that they're going to have to keep supporting people's jobs going forward.
What about this idea we talked about earlier, Steve Baker and others have raised, about bringing universal credit in line with some kind of universal basic income for the future? So trying to make sure that we don't end up with people simply, because this is another thing. I think Thangam Debonair, the shadow housing minister, and also our local MP here in Bristol West, I believe, isn't it? She was saying that, well, the moratorium on evictions is about to end. So all of a sudden, when people have been looking at their credit cards, their bank accounts, not being able to pay the rent, we could be facing right now, as of next week, an enormous wave of evictions. In fact, there's nothing to stop those landlords going to court to get eviction orders. They just weren't able to enact them. So it could be, a bonanza for the bailiffs in the next few weeks as people are hoofed out of their homes.
Well, I think that's what underlies the comment that was made by the other Labour spokesperson about not letting a good crisis go to waste. We should have had a universal basic income in place for years. It should have been brought in after 2008. We should have liquidated
the
banks.
Why didn't Labour do that?
Because Labour were voted out of power, if you remember, because they were blamed
they were
by
in
the
power.
Well, do you know why they didn't do it? Because they didn't have Jeremy Corbyn leading them in those days. And, of course, we're always playing catch-up, aren't we? What's going to happen now? The Tory government is now spending far more money than was possibly conceived of in the so-called spendthrift Labour manifesto, because, in actual fact, there is a magic money tree. And the Tories are really grateful to have discovered it. And that means that all of the cutbacks that we've faced over the last 10 years were totally unnecessary and significantly lost the country's AAA credit rating because they carried out too much austerity and the economy started to go down the drain. Now, in this situation, like all over the world, in Japan, they've been printing money since the 1980s. Because if you don't and you stop, the economy collapses. It's like a game of musical chairs. And what we should have done is we should have done all sorts of things years ago, but we didn't do that.
Let's get back to the question. Do you think there's going to be a bailiff's bonanza and a wave of evictions now?
There probably will. I see Momentum, the left-wing faction in the Labour Party, are now saying that they're gearing up to try and protect people from being evicted, because that is the next thing to happen.
On that subject, yesterday I was up on the Downs, and I bumped into a guy called Stephen... Eam, I think his name is. Anyway, he's the chief council enforcement officer of some sort. He's a council officer, and he had a little team of three people, and he had a clipboard, and he was going round to various vehicles which are parked up on the downs, issuing them with notices saying, you've got to move on. Here is a notice to leave. Now, he's not really saying where they should go to, although the council do have some sites that people living in vehicles can go to, but they've certainly decided, the city council, that they're not allowed to stay on the downs. So what we've got is, we've got a situation where people being hoofed out of their homes, one of the obvious things to do is to get a vehicle, live in that, because it's much cheaper than trying to get rent. And then the council are then saying, well, you can't live here, you've got to have to go.
Well, there's going to be all sorts of social consequences of the situation we're in, aren't there?
I bumped into a chap up there who lives around Clifton, and he was saying, I don't want my council tax being spent on this. These people have got nowhere else to go. You're telling them to leave the Downs, but where else are they going to live?
Well, I'd sympathise with their situation.
It's a bit like the gypsies in the old days, isn't it? You know, where people would say, oh, you know, you've got to go. But then they would say, well, where do you want us to go to? And we've had itinerants in this country for thousands of years. Why is it now we've decided that no one is allowed to live in a vehicle, even if they're incredibly poor?
Well, in the United States, lots of people live in vehicles, and people live in sewers and in shanty towns. And we're going to be more like the United States. And that's where we're going.
And COVID is helping us on our way with all these restrictions, the latest restrictions. Anyway, so before we leave the subject of COVID, I thought we ought to have a listen to Dolores Cahill. We heard from her last week, but I think it's a very, very important subject. Now, anybody that's considering having the flu vaccine, particularly if you're elderly, I think you should think again. And certainly do some research before you do that, because there is this thing called viral interference. We've mentioned it on the show a couple of times over the last few months. I think I mentioned it when I was over in New Zealand, Martin. And this is this whole concept. In fact, I think it was Dr. Judith Brown that mentioned it in a speech she gave in Castle Park too, that if you have the flu vaccine, that can actually make you far more vulnerable to dying of COVID, because the one vaccine is interfering with your ability to fight the virus. So let's have a listen to Dolores Cahill talking about that now, and also how she's a doctor, by the way, epidemiologist, one of the Europe's top epidemiologists, who's very much turned against the medical government establishment on this subject of viral interference, and also on masks.
It's well published, this viral interference priming, and that it would be immoral to be recommending a potentially, you know, influenza vaccine for corona when this viral interference is potentially one in three people for an illness that was not, you know, was very rare, that would not kill anyone. So I can just give you, there is no need for the lockdown. There's no need for teenagers and people to be wearing masks. And if you do wear a mask, you will have psychologically, you'll have anxiety, you know, for teenagers. There's huge increases, there will be, in suicides. And there will be increases in diseases like pleurisy and pneumonia and chronic fatigue. But the worst thing is, and it makes sense, this is all common sense. When you have a mask on, you're rebreathing your air, so you don't clear your carbon dioxide. So you have very quickly, in America, 2,000 parts per million is the safe dose above you can't work. But when you wear a mask, it goes up to 8,000, which is essentially, you know, parts per million. It's like 20, 30, 40 times. You get headaches, you get chronic fatigue. It's like working in a dangerous environment. You're not supposed to work in 2,000 if you were working in a room. And wearing the mask is the equivalent of working in a toxic carbon dioxide, and you have less oxygen. It suppresses your immune system. It also activates any latent viruses you have, so that you will be more sick for the next flu season, as well as, you know, 90% of communication is nonverbal. So you have, you know, loneliness and anxiety, and it actually subconsciously makes you stressed when you can't see people's expression, because your subconscious part of your brain doesn't really know what basis, whether they're, you know, friendly or not. You can't actually read the clues. So there's no need for lockdown. There's no need for not having churches. There's no need for social distancing. And it can all be gone overnight.
Dr. Doris Cahill, Martin, making lots of points there, but particularly about the masks, and talking about actually how can increase your risk of infection if you're wearing a mask long term. I can just tell you anecdotally, in a shop I was in a few weeks ago, the lady was serving behind the counter with a mask on, and she was chatting to one of the customers saying that she was getting dizzy spells. I said to her, look, you know, you don't have to wear a mask. If you're getting dizzy, if it's actually making you ill, take it off. And she just said to me, well, thank you very much, because she wasn't sure she was allowed to do that. There's a lot of people who are wearing masks out of fear rather than out of any medical reason.
Well, I believe the way shop workers are now going to be told they do have to wear masks. So that's definitely not part of...
Well, I would imagine this lady won't be able to do her job.
Well, maybe she will, maybe she won't, Tony. I don't know what you want me to comment on this. That's her view. Other doctors have different views.
We just heard a lot about masks from Dolores Cahill, and so you can comment on any of that. There's all sorts.
Well, I mean, basically, I listen to what various doctors are saying, and I take it all with a pinch of salt. Don't forget, I'm a political conspiracy theorist.
Okay,
I'm interested in biological warfare.
If you want to talk conspiracy theories, why did the World Health Organization switch its advice from no masks to masks just before the whole idea of masks a couple of months ago was brought in that we had to wear them? So, I mean, it just seems the science is contradictory, and that the scientist, whoever it is at the time, whether it's Patrick Vallance or anybody else, just picks the bit of science that they choose. They're not actually having any kind of objective decision.
Well, in Southeast Asia in general, and in China in particular, they always wear masks when they think there's some kind of viral epidemic, because that's what they've dealt with SARS.
They've been programmed to do that.
Yes, they have. Under the evil social credit system in China. That's right.
Well, it's nothing to do with the social credit system, is it? Well, although it might be, I suppose. If you don't wear a mask,
that's right, yeah,
then your social credit score will go down and you won't be able to travel.
Yeah, well,
so this is basically authoritarian intimidation of the population. And you're saying that's good?
No, well, in Hong Kong, where they haven't got such rules, people wear them anyway. And in Singapore and other places, in Southeast Asia, they wear masks. They don't have this kind of, oh, we're not going to wear a mask stuff. And, of course, they've done far better than we have in terms of controlling the virus.
There's been a lot of censorship of the doctors that we've been hearing on YouTube.
So, okay.
But, interestingly, I'm not so sure this is really YouTube doing this.
Can I just make a point about masks, since we're on masks? The point about wearing masks and why they wear them in Southeast Asia isn't to protect yourself, it's to protect others. And, of course, in China, and Japan and other places, that's a perfectly straightforward idea.
I mean, it's both, isn't it? Mm. Obviously.
Well, no, because anyway, she's talking about it only in terms of what it does to you, not what it does to others.
Oh, yes, but if it's actually affecting you, giving you pleurisy, pneumonia, chronic fatigue syndrome and these sorts of things, these are important considerations, especially if you're not actually subject to any, if you're not actually spreading, you don't have any virus yourself at all.
Well, if you do, then, of course, the mask helps protect others from your...
Well, this is a big if, which the tests are saying, yes, you do,
right,
whereas various doctors, like the one we just heard, Dr. Yeadon, are saying you don't. So this sort of science is...
Different cultures have a different approach to wearing masks.
And some are authoritarian, and some aren't.
Yes, and some countries have actually managed to get on top of the virus, so there's no virus at all. That'd be communist China, one quarter of humanity, who've had a tenth of the deaths that we've had in their huge population.
And some extraordinary populations are more brainwashed than others, aren't they?
Yep, and that's when it comes to the fighting in the South China Sea. Our lot will run away, and
maybe
the
brainwashed ones will fight better, eh?
They will. They usually do.
Great. Anyway, Dr. Vernon Coleman this week is talking about he's very annoyed with YouTube. And as I was starting to say just now, there are questions about whether there is actually a very, very strong orchestrated campaign online to make lots of complaints against videos which appear on YouTube, and actually maybe even to make stuff up to try and get them removed from YouTube, which I've had on some of my videos this week. Dr. Vernon Coleman has decided he's had enough of YouTube, and he's given them a nasty new name. He's decided that they're not very nice. And this week, he's gone on to this thing called Brand YouTube, which is great. It actually works just as well, and it's not so censorable by Google. So this is, it seems to me that Google is starting to die off, and maybe new services like this Brand YouTube will be taking over, and I hope they do very well and they don't censor things like Google has been. So here's Dr. Vernon Coleman, Martin, floating the idea that we may look back on the days today as the good old days, because things could be getting much worse.
In Screw YouTube's upside-down world, it's now even illegal to tell the truth about the BBC's lies. I suggest you stop using YouTube, screw YouTube, completely. A boycott would hurt them. But oddly, no one fact-checks Prince Charles. He now claims that we need four planets to sustain us. This is bollocks, of course. There's plenty of food on the planet. It's just usually in the wrong place, and much of it is wasted. Charles is a loathsome hypocrite and an idiot. The entire royal family should be defunded and sold off to the highest bidder if anyone bids. Charles, I suspect, is far too ignorant to know that in 1991 the Club of Rome published a book entitled The First Global Revolution, in which it admitted to inventing modern climate change as a common enemy of mankind in order to unite the world. In the old days, journalists used to check press releases. These days, they just put their name at the top of the press release and hand it to their editor who prints it. But the enemy is moving fast, and through its control of the mainstream media, has a huge reach. We too need to move fast, and we need to widen our reach. Things are never going to go back to the real normal unless and until we make that happen. And I believe the best way to do this is to distribute leaflets, and you're the best person in your locality to do this. Get leaflets printed and hand them to friends, neighbours and relatives. If you have a shop, put a pile of leaflets on the counter or put one in with each purchase. Or, when you're allowed to leave your home, put leaflets through letterboxes. Incidentally, it's usually cheaper, apparently, to get a local print shop to print 500 or 1,000 leaflets than to print them on your own printer. Have different leaflets printed on different coloured paper. Be warned, however, that you'll doubtless annoy some people. They don't want to know. They'll label you mad. You'll be described as a conspiracy theorist, a right-winger, and far worse. People will try to demonise you and the truth. The truth is, I'm afraid, that sadly, if you don't lose a few friends, then you probably won't be making a difference. I know using leaflets may seem old-fashioned, but leaflets are a traditional way of spreading the word. Resistance movements have used them since printing was invented, and so have individuals with an important message to share. Jonathan Swift was a great leafleteer and pamphleteer.
So that's Dr. Vernon Coleman there, Martin. I'm not sure about this whole thing of leaflets. Can't we spread the virus on Vernon Coleman's leaflets? He's not being very medical there, is he?
Well, he doesn't. He obviously doesn't think there's much problem with spreading the virus. So why not hand out leaflets? Although, of course, as he says, they are actually rather old fashioned.
What about this idea, though, about that things could get a lot worse, and that we could be looking upon this where we are at the moment as the good old days? I quite like the way he makes provocative comments like that. It just makes you think. It's a bit like when we had Manfred Petrich on here saying that he thought that Putin had spread the virus in order to finish off capitalism.
Well, I don't know I'd never heard him say that. But anyway, well, of course, I come on here week after week, Tony, and say things are going to get worse. So I certainly agree with that.
You agree with him.
But of course, it's not for the reasons that he thinks, and it's about things that he's not even thought about.
But he may be also, I mean, he's also talking about the Great Reset being a great disaster, basically a kind of financial crash. He's also been warning about war too. So yeah. He's in a way, you know, sort of...
Well, I mean, basically, you don't need a crystal ball, Nostradamus, or the Book of Revelation to see. If you, any mainstream historian can tell you, the chances are we're going to have the biggest crash in history, followed by World War III full on, because it started ages ago, and lots of people have already died.
I'm not sure if you saw this, but also this week, there's a story in the BBC about the Wandsworth Council. And Wandsworth Council apologised over something called an emergency grab-and-go bag tweet. The Wandsworth Council, a Tory council, tweeted that you should have a grab-and-go bag, a pen and a notepad, a torch, a first aid kit, personal toiletries, seasonal clothing, a phone charger and a battery bank, food and water. It's getting bigger and bigger, this grab-and-go bag. I'm not sure quite how long that food is supposed to last you. You can't really take a larder with you. Batteries, whistle and an emergency plan. A South London council has apologised after a tweet advising people to prepare for emergency evacuation sparked an online backlash. They advised residents to prepare an emergency bag in case you need to flee your home immediately on Sunday on social media. Hundreds of social media users demanded an explanation for the post. "We're sorry," they said, "to have caused alarm." The post was part of a National Preparedness Month campaign. The council is taking part in a 30 days, 30 ways UK, which aims to build household and community preparedness and resilience. But it's actually quite frightening, the idea that you're going to suddenly be told you're going to have to leave your home.
Well, I mean, and of course, what happens if you're told to stay in your home is just as likely as being told to leave it. You know, it's just a slight,
They said it's part of an annual national campaign. So every year, Wandsworth Council tells their residents that they've got to get prepared a bag so they can grab it if they get told they've got to forced to leave their home. And of course, what they're implying there is that you may have to leave your home permanently. So what are they preparing for exactly?
Well, I suppose it could be flooding of the Thames. Nuclear war, running away isn't going to help you.
I mean, I think if you get away from a target, it might help you. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be in the middle of a nuclear bomb, do you?
I suppose, yes, get out of the city.
Anyway, back to Prince Charles and that amazing accusation there that it turns out to be true. He wasn't joking this time, Dr. Vernon Coleman was making. Prince Charles is warning that we need four planets like Earth if we want to survive. But we just take and take. He sounds like a sort of official version of Greta Thunberg, doesn't he? And urges companies to focus on the green recovery following the coronavirus. He spoke on a recorded message from Balmoral up in Aberdeenshire, which he probably flew to on his private jet, and stated that at a current rate, we would need four planets like Earth to survive. He's championing today's launch of something called Sustainable Platform ReTV. What do you make of this, Martin? Do we actually need four planets to survive?
Well, Mahatma Gandhi said many years ago, there's enough for everybody's need, but not for some people's greed. And if everybody was to live at the level of the average middle-class American, we'd clearly need to have a hell of a lot more resources than we've actually got.
I mean, there is a bit of a nasty eugenicist taste to this, isn't there? Because he's involved in this great reset. He's obviously very pally with people like Bill Gates and Klaus Schwab from the World Economic Forum. Do you think Prince Charles is sort of secretly rubbing his hands and hoping that three-quarters of humanity will be wiped out?
Well, these issues are there to be faced by the whole of humanity. I'm sorry to bring up the Chinese Communist Party again, but they've rescued us all from a massive population explosion with their one-child policy. And if they hadn't had a one-child policy, we'd already have doubled the world population for what we got now.
I mean, it sounds to me a little bit like Henry Kissinger, when Kissinger is warning, saying if you don't get this right, this great reset is going to happen. And it could actually, well, no, he's saying not the great reset, the reaction to the COVID alleged pandemic, if they don't get that right, then it could be all-out war. Basically, that's what Kissinger is saying. Well, Prince Charles seemed to be saying something rather similar, doesn't he? That we've got a real big crisis coming, and you're going to have to do as we say. That is to say, you're going to have to completely behave. You know, there's going to be some really big changes coming up in the next. I mean, I think, isn't it? The World Economic Forum is in January, so that'll be in the next 6 months.
Well, look, everybody's talking about the massive changes, social changes that are going to happen because the banks collapsed in September, far more important than the pandemic.
Well, he's saying,
and of course,
Martin,
the attempts to provoke China and Russia into a fight, Charles isn't
going down that route. What he's talking about is he's talking about the climate being a problem. And he's saying, actually, we must put ourselves on a warlike footing, approaching our action from the perspective of a military-style campaign.
Well, ultimately, climate change is a separate issue. It's one of the issues that we face. I suspect more likely than climate change is going to kill us is there's going to be a massive crash, which is going to cause it will lose millions of people in that crash. Loads of people will die as a result of it. There will be massive fighting, probably in most of the barrios and the favelas around the world. There'll be, you know, basically on the ground fighting between different groups. And people, you know, and we will probably have a massive decrease in the world population.
Prince Charles is wealthy enough to, and what he's doing is he's launching his own TV channel to warn the world about all these things. It's called www.re-tv.org. I'm not quite sure what it stands for, but anyway, I think it's Reset TV. Inspiring ideas, it says, for a sustainable future. 2020 has seen a great reset, an opportunity for us all to reflect on where we are and how we can rebuild the global economy. But what about his main point, Martin? Please, I'll bring you back to this, which is that there's only a quarter of the amount of resources on planet Earth that humanity needs to survive. That's what he's saying.
Well, the US military years ago said the problem we're going to face is that as people become more educated, they're going to get very fed up with the fact that we're hogging the world's resources. And that's the basic military problem we face.
And it sounds like Martin Bormann, Hitler's private secretary, saying every educated person is a future enemy.
Indeed, Brzezinski said exactly that as well, if you know who he was. The problem is we've got too many educated, you know, the education's spreading, people are going to realise that they're being hard done by, and they're going to...
Well, they're being conned, basically. Yeah,
well, ultimately, what will happen is the US will be defeated as it was defeated in Vietnam, the economy will collapse, and then people will be free. But of course, it won't be a happy business. It's not going to happen through peace and light and enlightenment. But as Mao Zedong pointed out many years ago, revolution is not a tea party or a picnic.
Well, basically,
it's an act of violence.
Prince Charles is saying that we're going to have to cut our emissions, basically. That will be the only thing to save the world.
Well, what will happen is emissions were majorly cut during the collapse of the Soviet Union. And of course, at the same time, the time that you die massively decreased. So people were dying in large numbers. And ultimately, probably what will happen as a result of the crisis we're in, lots of people will die, not from necessarily directly from climate change, but from war, disease and brutality. And that will reduce the amount of footprint we have. And then out of that, we might be able to rebuild.
We shall see. Okay, so let's go on to look at the annual Labour Party conference, which was all done on Zoom this week. Before we hear from the former MP Ruth Smith, who introduced Keir Starmer, Martin, say something a little bit about her, because she was a vehemently pro-Israel lobby MP that actually was removed by her constituents at the last general election in 2019. Why is it that Keir Starmer has actually brought her back almost from the grave, you know, to introduce him at the conference?
Well, he's basically establishing that he's the big boss.
But why have a former MP introduce him rather than someone who's actually been elected?
Well, he's giving the signal to the pro-Zionist faction in the Israeli embassy and elsewhere that he's one of us and that he can be trusted and so on and so forth. And
it's interesting, isn't it, that you actually decide, Ruth Smith, we thought she was history, but no, she's been resurrected. And here she is introducing Keir Starmer. We'll hear a couple of minutes of his, a minute or so of the beginning of his talk he gave, inaugural talk to the Labour Party Zoom conference.
Now we have to fix it. And that is why I'm here today, proud to introduce my friend and our new leader, Keir Starmer. Keir has already demonstrated that our party is under new management. But let's be clear, the country needs new leadership. At a time of an economic crisis and a public health emergency, we need competent, compassionate and credible leadership. And we are not getting that from the current resident of Number 10. A new leadership for our country to ensure we emerge stronger after the pandemic.
Huge honour of introducing me today. I know how hard the last few years have been for you. You exemplify the values I want the Labour Party to stand for. Thank you for everything you've done and that you will continue to do for this party. I'm delighted that we're here in Doncaster. My wife's mum was born and grew up here, just next to the racecourse. We're regulars here, visiting family friends, but also, of course, to go to the Ledger. Sadly, not this year. I'm also told that this is the first Labour leader speech in Yorkshire since Harold Wilson in 1967. The circumstances were a bit different then. For one thing, Wilson was able to update conference about Labour's achievements after 3 years in government. So I look forward to coming back one day in the same circumstances that brought Wilson here.
So that's the spirit of Harold Wilson. I've always said Harold Wilson, I think, was the last decent, honest, independent-minded prime minister we ever had in Britain. Jeremy Corbyn would possibly could have ridden to power, failed last year, mainly because he failed to deal with the Israel lobby in his own party, and also because he was shilly-shallying on Brexit. But anyway, what do you make of him invoking the spirit of Harold Wilson there, Martin? Because there's a lot of difference between Starmer and Wilson. It's almost like he's trying to put his arm round Harold Wilson and say, look, you know, this is the kind of guy I like, this is the kind of guy I am.
Well, I mean, you put your finger on it. That's exactly what he's trying to do. He's trying to come across as reassuring, comfortable, unthreatening, and all of that. And, of course, Wilson was ultimately removed by the MI5 plot because he was accused by the Americans of being a Russian agent.
That's the
real politics of the era.
This is the Wilson plot and the book The Enemy Within as well. Actually, I think that was about the miners' strike. But this was a fascinating episode in 19... Wasn't it when Wilson resigned was 76, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was in the late 70s.
And one of the fascinating things about that I found was that, I mean, there was a brilliant programme made about it, and the book, was it Barry Penrose and Roger Courtier?
Yeah.
Wrote about that whole business, where they had been speaking to Wilson about that whole business, and suddenly they were working at the BBC doing a documentary on how Wilson was removed by the Secret Services and forced to resign by MI5, that they turned up for work on a Monday morning at the BBC to carry on making their documentary, only to find that all of their papers, all the research work for their documentary had disappeared, and there was a padlock on the door. So they were basically sacked over the weekend by MI5 nicking all their programme material. So anyway, let's have a listen to a bit more from Keir Starmer's big speech, his maiden speech, the Labour Party Zoom conference, which, I don't know, without the kind of audience laughing or clapping in the background, it sort of lacks something, I think. But anyway, here he is talking about undoing the damage done, not by the Conservatives, but by Jeremy Corbyn.
We're becoming a competent, credible opposition. But that's not enough. I didn't come into politics to be in opposition, and neither did you. I came into politics to change lives. But you don't get the permission to act unless the public trusts you. And we still have a lot to do. I don't underestimate the work that will be needed. But I can make this promise. Never again will Labour go into an election not being trusted on national security, with your job, with your community, and with your money. That's what being under new leadership means. And the best incentive for being deadly serious about victory is to remember why we want to win. I don't want to win power just to be Prime Minister. I want to win because of the country I love and because of the values I hold dear. When you win, you come out of the shadows. You change lives. You make a difference to your country. To do that, we must once again be the party of the whole United Kingdom, the party of England, Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland. We must make the case much more persuasively that we achieve more together than we do alone, to stop the nationalists ripping our country apart by design, and to stop the Tories dismantling it by neglect. I'm not the sort of leader who wants to turn the clock back. Times change, and so do political priorities. But let's remind ourselves of what this party can achieve at its best. This is the party that founded NATO.
This is the party that founded NATO. It's a bit cheeky because he went on to say other things like the NHS that they'd founded, but I thought I'd cut it off there because it's like he's launching into the great achievement of the foundation of NATO.
Well, that's because he is very much, he's on the Council on Foreign Relations. He's very much an insider. And he's that kind of guy.
And you voted for him, didn't you? And here he is championing great, good old NATO, a fantastic organisation.
The problem for him is that he's never going to be Prime Minister unless there's a change in the electoral system. Scotland quite possibly won't even be voting in the next general election in this country because they could be independent.
I think he's never going to be Prime Minister until he can do a decent speech and sound convincing.
Well, from his point of view, that is a convincing speech, Tony. He is trying
to...
Well,
he's being backslapped by a whole load of toadies to say, wow, wonderful speech. Well, fantastic speech. Actually, it's really... It was a US-style speech.
It was.
It was almost as if he's having his scripts written by, like the BBC are, by the way, by Americans.
Well, what it is this whole idea of chasing swing voters in marginal constituencies. And that's the same as the American system. And that is actually the wrong system. We should be running our country like the Irish or the Danish or the Norwegians do, with a PR system where people can say what they think and mean what they say.
This is going to have an impact, isn't it? Not necessarily this particular speech, but Starmer's style of leadership on whether Labour retains Bristol next May.
Well, I think Bristol West, the Greens have probably got that on their target list. And it's quite possible that a lot of the Labour left listening to that kind of speech might decide to vote Green. And of course, that won't make a huge difference, even if places like Bristol West and Brighton and maybe Norwich went green. That's not going to change the generality of politics in the country.
So did Labour deserve to win the December 2019 election, Martin?
Well, the Tories certainly didn't, because they only got 43% of the vote. And in any other European country, they would never have been the government, even in 1979.
Well, I'm afraid Keir Starmer disagrees with you. He thinks it was Labour that deserved to lose the 2019 election. So he's more interested in having a go at Corbyn than he is about having a go at the Tories. Maybe he's another Blair.
Well, that's exactly how he's positioning himself, isn't it? Don't forget, Blair won 3 elections under first past the post.
So, anyway.
So what we're doing is the same old stuff we did before, which, of course, is just the same old stuff. So when he's saying we're going to do new stuff, he's basically saying we're going to do the old stuff.
Boris needs to be incredibly terrible for this guy to stand a cat in hell's chance. But anyway, let's have a listen now to him talking about how terrible Labour was last year and why his party deserved to lose.
My vision for Britain is simple. I want this to be the best country to grow up in and the best country to grow old in. A country in which we put family first. A country that embodies the values I hold dear. Decency, fairness, opportunity, compassion and security. I've tried to be constructive. I appreciate that these are unprecedented times. And that governing is hard. I've tried to be fair, to give the government the benefit of the doubt. But now, with one of the highest death rates in the world, on the threshold of one of the deepest recessions anywhere, I'm afraid there is no doubt. This government's incompetence is holding Britain back. So let's be blunt. Let's be brutally honest with ourselves. When you lose an election in a democracy, you deserve to. You don't look at the electorate and ask them, what were you thinking? You look at yourself and ask, what were we doing? The Labour Party has lost 4 general elections in a row. We've granted the Tories a decade of power. The Tories have had as many election winners in 5 years as we've had in 75. It's a betrayal of what we believe in to let this go on. This is the big difference between the Prime Minister and me. Whilst Boris Johnson was writing flippant columns about bendy bananas, I was defending victims and prosecuting terrorists. While he was being sacked by a newspaper for making up quotes, I was fighting for justice and the rule of law. The grown-up way to deal with Brexit is to negotiate properly and get a deal. And on Brexit, let me be absolutely clear. The debate between Leave and Remain is over. We are not going to be a party that keeps banging on about Europe. Times change, and so do political priorities. But let's remind ourselves of what this party can achieve at its best. This is the party that created the National Health Service and founded NATO. This is the party of the Equal Pay Act, and this is the party of the Open University.
Yeah, so, yeah, we just heard that a little bit. He's giving him a bit, really good rollout this week, Martin, Keir Starmer. But it's pretty shocking, isn't it, for him to really be going on about how terrible the Labour Party's done. I mean, surely this is the idea, is he's got to try and rally the troops, hasn't he? To get members like you to say, wow, yes, we can do it. We've changed now, we've got a new leader, it's all guns blazing, let's go. But he seems to be, you know, sort of pouring over some old wounds, particularly the wound of the last year's general election.
Well, I think from his point of view, he probably thinks he's got to say all this nasty stuff now because he's got 4 years before the next election. And of course, it's going to be a first past the post election and he's got to win over the red wall, which is just shows how dim they are, basically. There is no way back to a Labour government in this country, as they've realised in New Zealand in the 1980s, without changing the electoral system.
Oh, well, you're not going to do that. That's just going to be impossible.
Well, no, we're not.
So,
but the Scots are going to walk out of the system, then, aren't they?
What should the Labour Party's tactic be then?
Or what he could have done is he could be reaching out to non-Labour voters like Liberal Democrats, Greens and Nationalists and saying, why don't we all get together and kick the Tories out? But he's playing the old Labour is the only game in town game, which is pretty much what Corbyn did, which was equally silly. I said to Corbyn when he came down, he was trying to get elected as the leader of Labour, what about PR? In New Zealand, the left wing of the Labour Party forced PR against their own useless government at the beginning of the 1980s. And Jacinda Ardern is going to walk home in the election that's coming up in October in New Zealand. And they've got dominance in that country because they changed the electoral system 30 years ago.
So why is Starmer so dim?
Because he's stuck in the past like they all are. Both Corbyn and Starmer are stuck on the idea that we're not going to change the electoral system.
Let's give poor old Starmer totally a chance and see if he can come up with something right at the very end of his speech. Here he is going for his big crescendo.
To those people in Doncaster and Deeside, in Glasgow and Grimsby, in Stoke and in Stevenage, to those who have turned away from Labour, I say this. We hear you. Never again will Labour take you or the things you care about for granted. And I ask you, take another look at Labour. We're under new leadership. We love this country as you do. This is the country I grew up in. And this is the country I will grow old in. And I want it to be the country I know it can be. That, in the end, is why I do this. To change lives for the better, to make a difference to my country. I know the good a Labour government can do, and I'm already looking forward to it. Thank you.
So, no big round of applause at the end because he's on Zoom at his Labour Party's annual conference. But I'm not sure. Did it do it for you, Martin?
Well, he's not saying anything that's surprising to me, but I come back to the point I'm making. What he's trying to do is win over the red wall voters. He may or may not succeed in that. They're probably more well-disposed to him than they were to Jeremy Corbyn. But in actual fact, it doesn't make any difference, even if he won all the red wall voters back. If Scotland walks out of the United Kingdom because they're fed up of being told what to do by politicians from London like him and Boris Johnson, then he can't form a majority anyway. We need to change the electoral system. We should have changed it years ago. They changed it in Ireland at the point of a gun in 1920.
So Keir Starmer, that was his speech from the virtual conference. But Martin, in the same week, Joe Glenton, the former soldier, is writing in the Canary, veterans slamming Labour's blatant fence-sitting as Starmer sacks ministers who dare to vote against the war crimes bill. Now, this war crimes bill is apparently going to change the legality of make it more difficult for people to prosecute soldiers who break the law when they're on active service. But military veterans have condemned Labour's mass abstention from a Commons vote on the Tory Overseas Operations Bill, which critics say could decriminalise torture, for example, during military operations. These are ex-soldiers saying this. Their comments come after a fiery debate in Parliament on the 23rd of December, which saw three Labour MPs, including the popular socialist Nadia Whittam, sacked for rebelling against party leader Keir Starmer's orders to abstain. So they voted against the bill, Martin. They're saying, actually, no, we think that British soldiers and servicemen should be accountable to the law as it stands. And they're sacked for their trouble.
Yeah, and the rest of them abstained. I think the idea is that they're going to you know, put amendments down on it.
I mean,
the SNP and the Liberals and the Greens all voted with Jeremy Corbyn and the 14 Labour members against the bill.
Why is Starmer saying that this is a three-line whip? You've got to do as I say, or you're sacked.
Because that's the way politics works.
It doesn't own all bills. No, certainly doesn't. And this certainly is a matter of conscience. Yeah,
he's made it a three-line whip matter, as is he's able to do.
So you're not allowed to vote against torture under Keir Starmer.
Well, this is where he's going to find trouble, because who voted against the bill? The SNP voted against the bill, to every single man and woman of them. The Green MP voted against. The Liberal Democrats all voted against. 14 Labour MPs voted against. Ben Wallace, the Tory Defence Minister, said, tried to attack Keir Starmer by saying that Keir Starmer supported an illegal war in Iraq. And he's now got into trouble with that because, of course, the whole Tory front bench voted for an illegal war in Iraq. And maybe they should all of them be going to the International Criminal Court.
We're going to be hearing a bit more about the Great Reset, the economic crash, maybe over the winter, and the global elite's ability to try and replace the old financial system with something else. We talked a bit about the homeless earlier on, Martin. I think admirable things someone can do if they're made homeless is to try and find somewhere to live for themselves, certainly through maybe buying on eBay an old camper van, living in that. It's much better than sleeping on the street, surely, isn't it?
Well, I mean, people have to make whatever choices they have to make when they find themselves in the situation they find themselves in. Younger, I had to do sofa surfing like many people.
Well, we're in
the
situation in this city where we've got a very active campaign by the mayor, Marvin Rees, to move on anybody that's living in a vehicle and to go onto one of the traveller sites. So, for example, the one out in Avonmouth is where they're supposed to move to, and that has got a motorway on one side, an incinerator on the other side, and a sewage works on the other side. It's not a very pleasant place to be, and certainly it's not within reach, Martin, easy reach of, say, if someone's got work in Bristol.
Well, that's right. I mean, if we're going to have a massive amount of evictions and redundancies, we clearly are, then loads of people are going to end up sleeping in cars willy-nilly, aren't they?
So Marvin is trying to get this injunction in St Werburgh's, right under the nose of Thangam Debonair, the Labour housing spokesperson, Shadow Housing Minister. But a survey in Travellers Times this week is saying even the police don't want more powers to evict traveller camps. So the Travellers Times have sent Freedom of Information requests and letters round to every police force in the country. In the consultation that the government's doing at the moment, they are threatening to make trespass a crime, resulting in prison, a fine, or your vehicle being taken away. So just making you homeless, great, thanks very much, government. Or making it a crime for you to stop alongside or on the road. Making it so that police can act when there are two vehicles instead of six at the moment is the law. If there are six vehicles or more, the police can act. A car, a trailer and a van would count as three vehicles, for example, in this new legislation that they're consulting on at the moment. Make it so that police can force you to go to a transit site in another county. So basically saying that, we don't want you around here. You're going to have to go maybe anything up to 100 miles or 50 miles away. And make it so you're banned from an area for 1 year instead of for 3 months. That's what the current law is at the moment. So there's an enormous amount of pressure by this city council to go along with this, and that's what Marvin Rees has been doing, Martin. But the police forces are saying, well, they're not interested. They don't think the police... Basically, what's happening is local authorities and private landowners who want to move on people who are living in vehicles, and there are obviously is a whole wave of new people moving into vehicles as they get evicted in the economic crisis. They're saying, we don't want to have to do this through the courts. We want the police to take this on.
Well, I mean, the law...
The police are saying, no, we're not doing it.
The law is about to be changed.
Well, actually, the police don't say that, do they? They say, we don't want to do it. We don't think it's a good idea at all.
The law is being changed by the Tories in a more repressive direction.
And why is our Labour Council going along with all this?
They're using the existing laws, aren't they, Tony?
No, they're not. They're trying to bring in new injunctions to injunct people in vehicles out of parts of the city.
Yeah, but they can only bring in injunctions under existing law, can't they? Yeah? The new law is a new law. The Tories are trying to bring in new powers. The police, as you say, aren't interested.
But this is a preemptive strike, isn't it, for the Tories that Marvin Rees is doing here by trying to get injunctions across the city saying but you can go to jail for 2 years for staying in your vehicle in this part of the city. Why is he doing that?
Well, you'd better ask him, although he won't answer, as you well know. Basically, I imagine that a lot of the pressure on this, and we had Paul Smith on here the other week, who's just retiring. What you've got in
Well, he's resigned, doesn't he?
Well, really? he's retiring from the council.
Well, he says, uses the word retire, but he's well below retirement age.
Well, I know, he's retired, yes, but he's not resigned.
He's resigned from the council to take up a job outside the city.
That's right, because he's got
Because he feels he can do more in housing, in a housing association, than he could as head of housing at Bristol City Council, which doesn't say a lot for Bristol City Council.
Well, the point is the council hasn't got a lot of power to do a lot of things, actually. That's the idea that the council has got any power is a bit of a delusion. But anyway,
the police are saying that they think that criminalising unauthorised encampments is not acceptable. Complete criminalisation of trespass would lead to legal action in terms of incompatibility with regard to the Human Rights Act 1998. So the Tories are being lectured, and Marvin Rees is being lectured by the police, saying you can't just expect the police to go move people on all the time. Your job is to sort out housing, and you're just simply trying to do that by sweeping the fact that so many people are living in vehicles now and increasing numbers of them under the carpet.
Okay, well, I mean, I don't know why they've made these decisions. We ought to have a councillor on here, perhaps, to, you know, and as we used to do before the lockdown, to justify the policy. But, I mean, the fact is that lots of people, that what they claim they're moving these people on is antisocial behaviour. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not, but that's what the claim
is. When I was up on the Downs yesterday, there was no antisocial behaviour going on. There was just Steve Ayres, I think his name is. I'm not quite sure how to spell it. E-Y-E-R-S, Stephen Ayres, Stephen with a V, and his clipboard, just literally knocking on caravans, speaking to people, handing them notices, saying that they have to go within 2 weeks and they're not allowed to come back within 3 months. Now, there's also been a letter sent by a solicitor working with Vehicles for Change, which is a little group that works with people living in vehicles, to the council, saying that they believe that this is unlawful what they're doing and that they should stop it right away. But the council is persisting with putting notices on vehicles saying that they've got to move, although, of course, they're not really telling them where they can go.
Well, I mean, if the solicitor is right and the council are acting illegally, then that's the answer to that.
Don't you think
it?
The city council should be providing housing instead?
Yes, I do. But of course, the fact of the matter is that the councils that sell off their council housing stock, the Tories have insisted that that housing associations sell off their stock, and they've just about managed to get some council housing built because they've actually relented about that. But we stopped building social housing properly in this country 30 years ago.
So we have to
when
move.
Margaret Thatcher came to
so
power on a minority
that
of the
means
vote.
That this Labour council has to move people on if they're living in vehicles on the Downs. We're not near anybody else.
Well, you'd have to ask them to justify that
rather than me.
Just
to move it on to another part of the country where the Bristol City Council is no longer responsible for housing them.
Yeah, well, I will make this point. How many people living in vehicles are registered to vote? And the answer is not very many. So therefore, from the point of view of the council winning a council election or a national election, it's pretty much of a no-brainer. They could decide to help them if they wanted to, but there's no, since they're not actually in the system and don't count, and even if they did count because of the electoral system, that would just pile up Labour votes or Green votes in the inner city.
Did you just hear you right saying that homeless people don't count?
They don't count in the electoral system if they're not registered to vote.
Do they not count as people?
They do, but as you know, politics.
So, in which case, why is the council using the waste budget, treating them like fly tip rubbish?
Because you have to ask the council why they're doing that. It's not. I don't have to defend that, Tony. It's not my position.
It's a very peculiar brand of Labour that we've got here in Bristol.
Well, what you've got in general is that some people are quite keen to see travellers moved on. We all know the kind of people they are. They're what they're called Karens in the United States. Those people generally vote, and therefore they're taken notice
and
of.
And so they complain to the city council.
Indeed.
Although on the Downs. Who lives on the Downs?
Well, I don't know, Tony.
It's mostly empty. Anyway, we're going to be revisiting...
You could argue that if they allow people to establish the principle that they're allowed to stay on the Downs as this recession builds and people are kicked out of their houses, you're going to have a situation where they'll have a shanty town on the Downs. That's what happens in the US.
It's almost certain to happen, but the council is trying to make sure it doesn't. It's sweeping.
Well, that's why they're doing it now.
Sweeping their responsibility to house people and treat them like human beings under the carpet. Thanks to Martin, Irish Republican Labour activist there. Join us in a minute as we take our weekly look around the world. And Martin, are you a fan? Have you ever been a fan of the Stone Roses?
Not really.
Right, well, I rather like them back in the early 90s, late 80s. And here is a song just out from Ian Brown from the Stone Roses, all about the virus. It's called Little Seed, Big Tree.
We don't need no stinking badges.
Living here is drastic. Doctor evil and his injecting them in little kids' arms. We just shoot them right into the vein.
But you don't have a choice. People act like you have a choice.
Well, I can remember from about 1989, the Stone Roses, but that was from just a week or so ago, and his name is Ian Brown, who's the Stone Roses front man, and that song is called Little Seed, Big Tree. Martin, the whole idea of creating a kind of culture here, I mean, that's, for example, not played on the radio, is it? None of these things that we play in between the first hour and the second hour are being played at all on the radio. Back, if you were to go back to, say, for example, the Vietnam War years, right, 1960s and 70s, there was a tremendous amount of protest music around, protest songs, which were being played all around the world.
Well, I mean, if you remember, at one stage, Radio Caroline existed because BBC wouldn't play pop music in general. So I don't think we can think back to the era, era of freedom of speech.
Where we are, but it was because of Radio Caroline, certainly freedom of culture. And I suppose what I'm trying to do is what they were doing then. And I've had various people say to me that when listening to your show sounds like pirate radio.
Well, there you are. That's the ultimate
compliment.
Yeah, but really. I mean, the fact is that people, because of the technology changes, people can now produce a pretty listenable product for a relatively inexpensive amount of money. But of course, back in those days, Radio Caroline existed, but of course, they needed a ship, which is quite expensive. It's not just a studio, is it?
I don't think it takes a lot of money to make music, does it really? I mean, say, for example, I was reading the other day about the band Hawkwind, who were just some record producer, just saw this guy strumming away and playing as a busker, and he was picked up and given a recording contract. Basically, he was got a few more mates together, and off they went. Hawkwind, the band.
Well, I think in the late 70s, there were lots of independent labels which grew up and so on. So there was a period when, the way the music industry operated was transformed, particularly in this country. But what tends to happen...
Where are the impresarios today? There aren't any, are there, that are finding new talent and bringing that talent
on? Well, listen, there's the big entertainment companies are still churning out their product. They're making big money out of it.
I would recommend people have a look at Mark Devlin. He was on our show last week. We only had a fairly short clip from him, but there's a much longer interview there about what's happened to the music industry. Mark was on Galaxy FM here in the 1990s and into the noughties in Bristol on FM. And now he's decided that, well, he's come out with the same sort of stuff that we talk about mind control, conspiracies, financial manipulation of political parties, censorship in the mass media, and he's found himself lost his job. But he's been writing a lot about the music industry. What he's saying effectively, Martin, is that the cultural industries are an enormous target in the battle against humanity by the global elite.
Well, the production of culture has always been a battleground for different ideas. And look at all the people who are making a living by just putting stuff up on TikTok. That wasn't possible in my youth.
People are making a living by putting stuff up on YouTube, but then I got demonetized just after the 2016 Brexit vote, when I had one of my videos called What the BBC Won't Tell You About Brexit went over 1.7 million hits, and I started getting some real revenue, and suddenly YouTube decided, oh no, we're not going to monetize you anymore. So of course, anybody that's actually getting somewhere with this alternative media, but certainly if it's part of the kind of YouTube, Google fraternity, Twitter, Facebook type people, they're demonetized, so any potential income that you've got from that is cut off rather swiftly.
Well, the other thing they're doing as well, of course, is changing the algos so that when you search for something, most people only look at the top two, three things they find, and you can still be there. But if you're on page two, you've got no chance of anybody finding you. And basically, these are private companies which are embedded with the deep state, and they're under no obligation to give everybody a fair go any more than the Daily Mail is. And that's free speech. If you, if you, if you, in one sense. Well, you can say what you like, but nobody can hear.
Yeah, it's a form of psychological warfare to just cut these things. We were hearing a bit about that from Indonesia, from Andre Vilcek, the things that he's discovered, that he discovered there about the 1960s, as you quite rightly said, Martin. Coup organised by Henry Kissinger in Indonesia. But let's look at some of the stories this week, Martin. And a lot of it is to do with sanctions, isn't it? US, UK and France are all putting sanctions on Belarus because apparently they didn't win. Lukashenko did not win the election, and also new sanctions going on to Iran from the United States. Iran is helping Syria rebuild its air defences after months of Israeli attacks, and that, I'm afraid, the US say, right, well, if you're helping the Syrians rebuild their air defences, we're going to sanction you.
Well, they're being sanctioned anyway. You know, it's hard to see what other sanctions the US, because they're withdrawing from the GCPRA, they're now saying that anybody who does deals with the Iranians, they will sanction them. And therefore, various companies have pulled out of Iran. But the Chinese, who are already under US sanctions, said, well, we will take over where those companies, you know, we will support you. So we're shaping, you know, the sanctions are effectively an act of war, and therefore we are basically at war already, and you know, it's going to get worse.
We'll have a, I think we'll start off though this week. I mean, there are, we'll cover some more of these international stories in a minute, but I think really Andre Vilcek was an incredible guy, wasn't he? I mean, I met him a couple of times, and I just also we used to interview him for this show from time to time, particularly anything to do with Russia and Eastern Europe. He was, like you, Martin, quite an expert on that.
Well, he's Russian, although he was a US citizen. Incidentally, he died, he's 55 years old, and he died in a car in Turkey, and the Turkish authorities, as I understand it, are treating it as potentially suspicious.
He was travelling overnight in his vehicle and arrived at a hotel in Istanbul in the early hours of the morning. His wife was driving the car, and then when she tried to revive him, she found he died in the back of the car.
Yeah, well, I mean, people die all the time, but as I understand it, the Turks are not necessarily happy that there's no foul play.
There's some suggestions he may have been poisoned. Why would anybody want to be rid of journalists like Andre?
Well, I mean, he basically was an enemy of the, to put no, you know, what people call the New World Order. He was against the US imperialist power. He's pretty left-wing in most of his views and attitudes. And, you know, as you know, he wrote books, he made films, he wrote poetry, he was quite prominent. And, you know, that's, those kind of people make enemies, don't they?
I think it was Exposing the Lies of the Empire. It was one of his big, thick books. But, I mean, he was a real campaigner against the, I suppose, Israeli, US, British world order, and NATO particularly.
Well, that's right. Therefore, you know, obviously, when he dies that young, in suspicious circumstances, it raises questions, doesn't it?
He worked in Chile as well. He lived for a while in Chile, and he was one of the people who was involved after Pinochet was removed in helping to denazify the country. Now, I think some people would be surprised to hear that there were real live former Nazis living quite happily in Chile.
Well, as you know, Tony, they were actually embedded in most of the right-wing dictatorships across Latin America, including Martin Bormann, because of your excellent research. People who listen to the show will be well aware of that.
So if you could just explain a bit about Andre's, well, I mean, what have you come across that he's, Exposing the Lies of the Empire is one of his greatest books. I mean, probably, I've never read it from cover to cover, but it's a great reference book for all sorts of, I mean, it's, in a way, he was doing what we do every week, which is to point out anomalies and lies and conspiracies that are real, not the bogus ones, because actually the extension of an empire, particularly at the moment, what we're seeing is the Israeli and the US empire being extended, depends on lies, doesn't it?
Well, of course it does, and the truth always is then regarded as a threat. You know, I didn't agree. What I used to find with about some of his stuff is it's a bit long-winded, to be honest. That's what I'd say about it. I often started reading his stuff and think, I've had enough of this, and flicked onto something else, because he was making lots of good points. But there's a great deal of kind of cultural baggage associated with the sharp political points. But nevertheless, he's clearly on the side of the angels, and it's a shame that he's gone.
Yeah, his one of his major targets was the Israelis and the US and the Brits. But he also went all the way around the world in many places doing films about small countries. Like, I mean, I know Indonesia is not a small country, but what he would do is places where the Western media was neglecting to go and to look at, he would then go in there and do that job.
I mainly come across his stuff on the internet. And he's a pretty mordant critic of Western imperialism, which of course is a real thing. It's not something people make up. Somebody ought to tell Keir Starmer.
Okay, what we're going to do is we're going to hear from Andre talking about Indonesia and the dumbing down of Indonesia after the coup first, and then we'll hear about his analysis from last week, just literally from last week, about Belarus.
When I was filming for Venezuelan Telesur, a documentary film about Surabaya, I was inside of the hall with thousands of people where the preacher was jumping around and yelling, God loves the rich and that's why they are rich. God hates the poor and that's why they are poor. Right? And then you have all sorts of...
That's almost humorous.
It is, but it is they really believe in this. It has nothing to do with, liberation theology, whatever. It's all extreme forms of the religion. So logically, in prosperity gospel, you go to the churches in Indonesia and you look at some of the services that are in English. They are performed by Australian and North American clearly apparatchiks. You know, I mean, these are people who are therefore indoctrination purposes. These are not just some kind of benign religious leaders. These are tough propaganda gurus, and they of course are following from the local priests. There is humongous corruption problem in the churches, in the mosques, and the West is supporting exactly these sorts of groups and these sorts of sects that are controlling the country. But Kevin, I would like to come back once again to the basic point of this discussion about Indonesia, about 65. One thing that the West doesn't know, and it was kept away from them, is that 1965 and what followed was one enormous experiment on human beings. It was something that was later used in many different countries, but actually you had a slaughter, you had a genocide, you had a Holocaust, in which 40% of teachers of Java were killed. The military was actually coming to classes to teach for some period of time. You had the greatest writers, like Pramudia Anantatur, who was imprisoned. His books were burned, and he was imprisoned for more than 10 years in a Buru concentration camp. He had entire film studios closed down. He had great theater forms of Indonesia totally destroyed. Everything thinking was marginalized. So it was not only Chinese language. It was generally everything. It was attempt to de-intellectualize the entire nation. So as I mentioned in my report about Indonesia, you have a country with 300 million inhabitants, because they lie, you know, they tell you that it has 245 million, but I worked with several UN statisticians and they say that they lie even about the number of people. So you have a number, or you have a nation with 300 plus million people without one, you know, recognizable scientist, without one great thinker, without any person that you could quote or you could consider an enlightened personality. The country which translates just the dozens of decent books a year, and the translations are of the horrific quality. You know, it's all a base. It was a force fed. By Hollywood films, by the lowest grade of pop music, languages, entire languages like Chinese language, like Russian language were either banned or they were totally marginalized. So they achieved something impossible. They achieved from one of the most progressive, they converted one of the most progressive nations on earth to one of the absolutely, least intellectual place. You can talk to Indonesians about anything, from connected to politics, to imperialism, to capitalism. They will not know what you are talking about. The other day I was talking about bombing of Laos during the U.S. Secret War. It's the same ASEAN, the same group of nations. You know, nobody knows about this. They don't know their own history.
Well, that's rather worrying, isn't it? History being controlled. But he Andre there talks, Martin, about this 1965 coup being an experiment on human beings. He was saying effectively, I mean, the slaughter of 40% of the teachers being killed, their jobs being replaced by the military, writers killed, film studios killed, theatres destroyed. This is a kind of cultural war going on.
Yeah, it was one of the biggest crimes of Western imperialism. The Sukarno regime, which was allied with the PKI, the Communist Party of Indonesia, the army got unhappy with that, and they were put up to it by the Americans with British support, of course, as usual, and they carried out a coup, supposedly because of an attempted coup by the PKI, although it's very, very murky what happened there. And then they killed the whole of the PKI's political base, which was up to 1 million people, and they killed them all in most horrible circumstances. And that's capitalist imperialism for you.
But what I find so horrifying about this is him talking about it as an experiment. So the idea is we're going to see how we get on with this, and then maybe we can use this tactic elsewhere. And this is who is he talking about?
Well, one of the things that happened.
I mean, we know Kissinger was involved.
Yeah, well, one of the things that happened in Chile, for example, before the coup in 1973, the right wing used to spray upon the walls, "Indonesia is coming." So that's what it was about. Yeah, it was a model for military coups all over the world against progressive governments. And, of course, it was a particularly brutal process. They killed a lot of people.
Obviously, it wasn't just against the government. It was against the entire nation. Basically, a massive dumbing-down operation to see if they could make people as uneducated and stupid as possible.
Well, it's the people they killed weren't being dumbed down. They were being killed. But then, of course, if you're going to carry on being in power, and Suharto, who took over, was in power for many, many years afterwards as a dictator, eventually overthrown after the 1998 economic crisis in Southeast Asia. But, of course, by that stage, you basically set the country on a capitalist development path, which is no use whatever to more than half the population. What might have happened is a democratic communist party could have come to power with Sukarno as a balancing force, and they could have actually transformed the country and been a positive impact around the world instead of the negative example which they subsequently... they then invaded East Timor in 1972 and put them under the cosh. With the full support of the Australians and the British, etc. And, of course, most people in Britain, if you ask somebody in Britain, do you know about the mass murder in Indonesia, they'll go, what? They wouldn't have heard of it. They'll have heard of the communists killing loads of people in China, but they won't have heard about...
But the interesting thing, point Andre's making there, is that people, even in their own country, don't know their own history.
Well, that's, most dictatorships want that to be the case, don't they? They want those who control the past control the present, and those who control the present control the future. So in actual fact, history is very important in any setup, because people are either aware of it or unaware of it, and that means that they can control current events. And, that's why it's important to keep going back. Who cares about what happened in 1965 in Indonesia? Well, it's just that the Western claim to be in favour of freedom and democracy is completely undermined by the massacre that was carried out. And it was pretty brutal stuff. I mean, I don't know if people have ever seen the film The Year of Living Dangerously, which is about that period. And it's a kind of, it's basically a romantic Hollywood film. There's a love story at the heart of it. But at the end of it, you get the idea, you realise that this is actually... far more people were killed in the Indonesian coup, for example, than were killed in Chile. Or in Argentina. Argentina was brutal. They killed tens of thousands. But in Indonesia, they killed millions. Millions of people were dead within weeks of the coup.
So what do you think Andre's legacy is going to be then? I mean, he was kind of squeezed out of much of the media in the West, but he did manage to be a regular filmmaker for example, Telesur in Venezuela.
Well, I think the fact that he's made all of these films and books, those they will stand the test of time. And, you know, in the past, of course, if somebody made a film, unless it was shown in some radical cinema down the road from you, you were never going to get to see it. But, of course, you know, he's died now. I encourage people to go to the internet, find his oeuvre, and watch some of his films. Why not?
There's not many people like him around, though.
Well, there aren't, no. There's Stephen Cohen has died in the United States, who was a very good analyst of Russia. And, you know, he's basically been shut. He remained in academia because they couldn't get rid of him because he was a professor. But they ignored him for years and years and years. And he's, you know, basically telling them common sense things about Russia. But he died of natural causes. He was quite old. He was in his 80s. Vilcek was only 55. So there's a definite suspicion involved. You know, people do die at 55, but somebody like him, as I say, the Turkish authorities are not necessarily presuming that there's no foul play.
Well, let's have a listen now to one of his final broadcasts. This is on Iran's press TV in English language when he was talking to Vladimir Goldstein.
From Belgrade a few days ago. Now, you have to understand about the government and the system in Belarus. There is no crisis, there is no big tragedy, there is basically a very balanced, socially balanced system. The industry is working, the medical is working, education facilities are working, and so is public transportation. So a group of people who is basically bored and whom Lukashenko is calling bourgeois, or young bourgeois, new bourgeois class, got bored. And they got also subsidized financially from the West, and they are doing precisely what the young kids in Hong Kong have been doing since last year. So there is nothing new. It is a coup, again, attempt by the West. It is very dangerous for Russia. And anyone who followed the situation, political, economical, and social situation in a neighborhood, neighboring Ukraine, would understand what is in store for Belarus if they are going to follow this concept, which is pushed down their throat from the West.
So that's Andrei Vilcek there, Martin, giving a bit of analysis last week about what's been going on over in Belarus, and he was speaking from Istanbul on Press TV.
Yeah, well, I mean, the analysis is pretty good. I was speaking exactly about this topic on RT yesterday. The main problem...
Look, what about what he just said about Hong Kong? He's talking about this as a kind of Ukraine-Hong Kong-style coup attempt. That's what he's saying.
It is. It is. I mean, Canvas, which was set up from Otpor in Serbia... it's basically the CIA MI6 1968 squad, and they basically got plenty of money to spend, and they go around the world encouraging relatively privileged young people to rebel against governments that the West doesn't like, and you know, they then use that as a leverage to try and get the governments out. It's usually not just that as well, they're doing other things at the same time. Lukashenko has been in power since for the last 26 years. He's won 5 elections. This is the 6th election, which he claims that he has won. Now, of course, in the West, you get this idea that if somebody's been in power that long, it should be time for them to go. We all know that democracy, you have to have 2 parties, a left-wing party and a right-wing party, and they're supposed to, you know, take it in turns to run the system, and that's democracy. In other parts of the world, it doesn't run like that. Lukashenko came to power in the early 90s. He used to be a collective farm manager, so he's like a middle manager. And what he did is he said to the people of Belarus, there's only 10 million people there, it's quite a small country, it's not small in size, but small in population. And he said, well, we're not going to change anything, we're just going to carry on as we were before. We're not going to get rid of the collective farms, I'm a collective farm boss, so we're not going to do that. We're going to carry on having state-run enterprises, so that all the major big factories and enterprises in Belarus are still owned by the Belarusian government.
How independent is he really of Putin, though?
Well, he's not that independent, because ultimately he's been able to pursue a welfare state, if you like, inside Belarus, because because for political reasons the Russians have carried on selling him gas and energy at less than world market prices. And of course that's a trade-off that the Russians are willing to make, because they, you know, basically Belarus for them is a buffer state between them and the West. And of course, all the Western analysis of this has presumed that he must have lost the election. And of course, in actual fact, it's more than likely that he won the election. He's won the last five. Why is he going to lose this one? And the answer is he's not. There's lots of younger people who've only just, you know, basically, if you're under the age of 26, you've lived under Lukashenko's rule all your life. And that probably runs into the 30s. You know, people in their mid-30s have never known anybody else running the country. And they get frustrated. You know, they want to have a Western-style setup where they can set up their internet startups and make loads of money. But, of course, the actual people who vote him in are the people who work in the collective farms and the state enterprises who don't want that at all.
The connection with here, I suppose, is that we were talking about a couple of weeks ago about RAF Fairford and these B-52s flying over there, Martin. These are big American aircraft taking off from Fairford, heading over to Ukraine and Belarus, and then flying along the right along the Russian border, right on the literally, you know, the bit of airspace a few inches away from Russia. Now, this does seem to be an excuse for the Americans to come and flex their muscles when things like this happen. But of course, they are also spending money on the ground, surely. NGOs in Belarus.
That's right. A lot of the people in the opposition are being paid to do the sort of thing we're doing for nothing. Yeah. They have, like, just Joshua Wong in Hong Kong. And, of course, one of the main things that most people who are protesting do not realise is that in the Maidan Square in 2014 in Ukraine, there was a big protest, you know, in the Maidan Square. The Berkut riot police were trying to police it. And then people infiltrated themselves into high buildings nearby and killed over 80 people.
The big hotel that's Ukraine,
right.
Wasn't it?
Yes, that's right, and the opera. And they killed, there were professional snipers, and they killed over 80 protesters and several police officers. And on the back of that, the government fell, even though they'd done a deal with the opposition about an early election, and Yanukovych had to flee back to Russia. There's been a court case in Kiev where the Berkut riot police have been completely vindicated. They did not shoot the demonstrators. And it was proved in the court because there was a video link to Georgia by two of the actual snipers. And they said all of the snipers were brought in by NATO from Georgia, and they killed both the pro-EU
demonstrators. So this was basically a NATO-EU-US court coup.
Yeah, but it's a
anyway,
false
flag. Talk about Alexei Navalny, because this week he's been discharged from hospital, another one who has managed to survive this deadly nerve agent Novichok.
Yes, which was designed to kill whole battalions of troops, but apparently it's been used twice and failed both times. Extraordinary, eh?
Incredible, isn't it, since it's such an incredible nerve agent. But the BBC talk about the background. They say Navalny's supporters initially believed his tea was spiked at Tomsk Airport in Siberia before he caught a flight to Moscow. However, they later said that traces of the nerve agent were found on a water bottle in the hotel room where he'd been staying.
Yeah, so what the story keeps changing as these things do. His entourage went back to the hotel where he'd stayed, and nobody had tidied up, and the water bottle that he'd used was lying there. So they took it away, and then they gave it to a military laboratory inside Germany. And then the military laboratory in Germany found Novichok on the bottle. But they'd carried it all the way there on an aeroplane, covered in Novichok. None of them got ill. And then they gave it to the military in Germany, and wow, they found Novichok on the bottle. Can you believe that?
In an Instagram post on Tuesday, Mr. Navalny rubbished suggestions, supposedly from President Putin, that he had poisoned himself.
he's probably, if he may well have been poisoned. Don't forget he's diabetic as well. So this may be just diabetes. But if he's been poisoned, he's been poisoned by something which doesn't kill him so that we can create this
well, yeah, there is a bit of evidence for this, though, because the French newspaper Le Monde reported in a telephone call from President Emmanuel Macron on the 14th of September, Vladimir Putin spoke with contempt about Alexei Navalny, considering him a simple internet troublemaker who had simulated diseases in the past. Putin has outsmarted me, Mr. Navalny wrote on Instagram, mocking the Russian president. He's nobody's fool as a result. I, like a fool, spent 18 days in a coma but failed to achieve what I wanted. The provocation has failed.
Well, I mean, that's just an exchange of words, isn't it? I mean, underlying all of this is that Navalny could have been poisoned. I think the Skripals were probably poisoned with something like fentanyl. And don't forget that the doctor in the hospital said, we've not treated anybody for nerve agents in this hospital in the Times the following day. But, of course, it all just disappears into the memory hole. I mean, it just doesn't pass the smell test, does it?
It doesn't.
It's absurd.
Look, just for a moment, just back to the B-52s, because you pointed out to me, Martin, over the border between Ukraine and Russia, that the Russian planes tried a rather smart manoeuvre on those B-52s, didn't they? They didn't just hang around. They rather showed that they were better flyers. Obviously, these little, I think they are Tupolev fighters or something, are rather better at flying than the old B-52s, aren't they?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hardly been reported in the West, but what they've been doing is flying nuclear-armed B-52s along the Russian border, from the north to the south, and then round the Crimea.
So I noticed.
So the Russians are basically looking at these B-52s that at any moment could fire a missile, a nuclear-tipped missile, into Russia. And that is, can you imagine if the Russians
the
were flying round
fair,
and round Britain
the Americans
with nuclear-armed bombers?
The Americans refuse to say whether there are nuclear weapons on there or not.
Well, the Russians have already said any missile that comes in our direction, we have to presume that it's nuclear. And therefore, we're going to full DEFCON 3 straight off, because that's the only way to deal with that. And, of course, what it means is, at some point, one of these planes will be shot down, and then the Americans will turn around to everybody, they've shot our plane down. Yes, so that's because you're flying them literally, you know, metres away from the Russian border, all the way along the Russian border. Now, that is just that's what the Irish call coat trailing, yeah? It's what they used to do at the county fairs. People would trail their coat on the ground, and people would stand on the coat to start a fight.
So the Russian Su-27 fighter, this is really at the end of last month, not this week or last week. I was quite amazed to watch the footage, and I put it up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, of the Su-27 hanging behind the B-52. Then what it does is it comes up quite close to it, and then it does a rolling turn right in front of the B-52, which creates a lot of turbulence and eddies, and you can see the guys who are filming in the cabin, the cockpit of the B-52. The whole plane is going up and down. It's wobbling because of the manoeuvre that the Russian fighter has done.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know where they actually carried out that manoeuvre. I mean, in actual fact, there are basically interceptions like that going on weekly, you know, several a week.
But the Russians are not taking it lying down.
No,
they're
no,
saying,
Shoigu, the defence minister, has said, if you come 1 inch into Russian territory, we're going to shoot you down.
Yeah, so this is the Su-27 fighter. So this is sort of thing is going on quite a bit. But what bothers me more than anything else is this: we've got these are all based in Fairford, just up the road from here. These B-52s.
Well, everything's connected to everything else. What's very important about this is, as I understand it, they've been flying along the official border between Ukraine and Russia. So in other words, they're overflying the Donbass and Luhansk republics, and of course they have got no air defence.
I actually admire these Russian pilots. That what they're saying is, look, just don't mess us around. The Pentagon has said the repeated manoeuvres cause turbulence for the B-52, making it difficult for the pilot to maintain control of the aircraft.
Well,
I don't want to. The losing control of a B-52 could be quite nasty.
Well, indeed, it's basically brinkmanship, and it ought to be made news in the West that we're doing this. And of course, what the Russians could do is do similar things in the North Sea. And at that point, people will be saying, what are they doing? What are they doing? But of course, they're not doing that because it's provocative and they're not acting provocatively, unlike the Western imperialists.
Talking about air power, US spy plane disguised itself while flying over the Yellow Sea. China said the US disguised its spy planes as civilian aircraft 100 times. According to a Beijing think tank that monitors flights in the region, US Air Force plane is disguising itself as a Philippines aircraft while flying over the Yellow Sea. The South China Sea Strategic Situation Probing Initiative observed the flight. Another flight monitoring agency, Aircraft Spots, made a similar observation, noticed the plane used a different hex code when it was over the Yellow Sea between China's coast and the Korean Peninsula. These are international numbers used to identify aircraft. It said the US Air Force plane used a hex code assigned to a Philippine aircraft while over the South China Sea, switched back to its original when the mission was over. So the Americans are using electronic trickery to pretend that they are Philippines aircraft when actually they're US military aircraft.
Yeah, well, what that leads to is a situation where some civilian aircraft may be shot down by accident. This is the sort of thing that's going on all the time. And just by accident, we could end up with a major international incident which will lead immediately to potential nuclear war. People ought to be paying a lot more attention to this than they are.
Meanwhile, looking at the Steele dossier, do you want to just remind us what that was, Martin?
Well, it was basically a sort of private sector cobbled together thing about how Trump was unfit to be president because he got the Russians had compromat on him, and it looks like the source for a lot of the gossip.
So we're saying the Russian could blackmail Trump.
Yeah, so a lot of the gossip. It was Christopher Steele who put the dossier together, who's ex-MI6. And Pablo Miller, who was also ex-MI6, who is, I think he's still in MI6, who was Skripal's handler. And Skripal was the source of lots of the gossip, including the very believable story that Trump paid for Russian prostitutes to piss on the bed that Obama had slept in. And of course, it was all you see, this is the Steele dossier and the so-called Russiagate affair are at the root of what happened in Salisbury, which has got nothing to do with the Russians at all. It's basically internal battles within the US and British security services.
So anyway, The Hill, which is a political paper in the US, is saying the Steele dossier source was a subject of an FBI counterintelligence probe this week. So a subsource used to compile the so-called Steele dossier, a controversial opposition research document against the candidate Donald Trump, was previously the subject of an FBI counterintelligence investigation, the Attorney General William Barr said in a letter released this week. Yesterday, in fact, the details previously redacted from a footnote in Justice Department Inspector Michael Horowitz's 2019 report on four Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act FISA court warrant applications. But US Attorney John Durham, tapped by Barr to review the origins of the FBI Russia probe, signed off on Barr releasing the detail to Senate Judiciary Committee Lindsey Graham, who's doing his own investigation into the FBI's probe into Russia's 2016 election meddling. So the declassified footnote states the primary subsource was the subject of an FBI counterintelligence investigation from 2009 to 2011 that attested that her documented contacts with suspected Russian counterintelligence officers. So anyway, the person's being investigated for actually exactly what the dossier is saying, which is for being involved with the Russians.
Well, both sides in the ridiculous debate about this in the US are accusing the other side of being in the pocket of the Russians. And, of course, the Russians basically have nothing to do with it. This is an internal struggle between different factions within the Western security services. The Russians basically are just being used as a weapon.
And what we're hearing here, of course, is a lot of stuff to do with disclosure. So this should have been disclosed early on. We're only ever getting half the truth with stories like this, aren't we?
Well, that's right, and who can follow all the tedious detail of it all? The fundamental thing, of course, is that the Democratic National Committee was rigging the primaries against Bernie Sanders in the run-up to the 2016 election, and somebody, probably Seth Rich, who was actually the head of the IT for the DNC, gave all the details on a memory stick to Craig Murray, the former British ambassador to Uzbekistan in Washington, And then WikiLeaks published it. And, of course, immediately the Democrats started screaming that the Russians had hacked their emails. Now, in actual fact, that nobody had hacked their emails. William Binney, who used to head up the NSA, said nobody hacked this. This came off clearly because of the electronic signal of it. This is somebody who's taken it away in a memory stick. And, of course, Seth Rich was then murdered in a so-called robbery where they didn't take either his credit card or his wallet. And that looks as if he was basically done in, because he was the one who'd passed the material to WikiLeaks. And what that material shows is that US elections are rigged. Now, even if the Russians had hacked that out and told everybody, they'd be doing us all a favour. But in actual fact, there were nothing to do with it. Basically, US elections are rigged. Can you hear that out there in radio land? They're rigged.
The US has cut, says the Middle East Eye this week, $20 million in funding for a group which is helping pro-democracy efforts in Iran. Well, that's an interesting one, isn't it? Because they've got a democracy in Iran. They don't have in many other countries. Maybe they should be spending this money in places like the UAE or Saudi Arabia, Martin. The Open Technology Fund supports activists operating in Iran, Belarus and Hong Kong, helping them bypass internet censorship and state surveillance. So the Trump administration has blocked a $20 million grant for a pro-democracy organization operating in Iran, Belarus and Hong Kong.
Well, I'd be interested to know why they've blocked that particular expenditure, because basically taxpayers' money, including British taxpayers' money, spent on things like the Integrity Initiative and the Institute for Statecraft are basically involved in manipulating elections and political situations all over the world at our expense. And therefore, you know, they then, one of the things they were caught out doing, of course, was spreading tweets attacking Jeremy Corbyn.
You want to know why? The article says that PAC has declined to comment, but his office suggested the funding freeze, as well as other changes, was implemented over security concerns such as OTF staff. This is the organisation concerned, using Zoom and being careless with computer drives. So obviously they're saying that you shouldn't be using Zoom because this is easy to put under surveillance.
But Zoom, as we all know, is a plot like TikTok by the Chinese Communist Party to spy on everybody. So that's possibly what that's about. But of course, it is Donald Trump who said that the buildings were bombed on 9/11, and it's Donald Trump who assassinated Soleimani, nearly starting World War III in January last year. I wouldn't vote for him. I wouldn't really want to vote for Biden either, but it's Hobson's choice, isn't it?
Also in a Middle East Monitor, MPs this week are urging the UK to recognise Palestine and boycott settlement products. Speaking during a House of Commons debate on settlements and annexation, UK members of Parliament called on the government to immediately recognise the state of Palestine. So that's another call for that happening here in the UK, Martin.
Yeah, but it won't get passed because the Tory majority, which are all pro-Israeli, will basically ensure that nothing happens.
Minister of State for the Middle East and North Africa, James Cleverly, said in Parliament yesterday, "We desire a stable, secure and peaceful two-state solution, a thriving Israel next door to a thriving Palestine based on the 1967 borders with agreed land swaps, Jerusalem as a shared capital of both states with fair, agreed and realistic settlements." But we're a long way from that, aren't we?
We certainly are.
Is he living in cloud cuckoo land? James?
No, what he's
not
doing,
very clever, is
no,
it?
No, what he's doing is they're pretending that they're trying to be even-handed when we all know that they're not. And of course, the Palestinians are being sold out now by the unelected governments of UAE and Bahrain. And of course, back in the day when we were having the Arab Spring, we were encouraging people to rise up and start fighting against Gaddafi and Assad. Get your guns out. And, of course, if they did that in Bahrain, obviously they're not going to do that, but they might. Obviously, in Yemen, British military personnel are directly involved in the biggest humanitarian crisis on the planet by helping the Saudi pilots are still training in this country. And then they go straight back to Saudi to bomb children.
In the US, Mint Press News are the reporting Kushner-linked firm and gig economy set to reap huge profits as mass evictions begin. So we were talking about this in the first hour here domestically, Martin, but it's happening in the US too. With threats of homelessness and bankruptcy in the air as eviction moratoriums subside, renters and small landlords are getting pinched by predatory tech capitalism in the gig economy. It's the real estate market. So what's happened is we've got these massive companies, Kushner linked. Jared Kushner, of course, is very well placed in the White House, pro-Israel lobby chap. And he's looking to actually make a lot of money out of these. Basically, what they do is these vulture capitalists sit and wait for things called distressed assets. So, in other words, where there is an asset that you're having to evict someone because they can't pay the rent, Kushner will come along and say, oh, I'll buy it for a song.
That's right. It's all there in Naomi Klein's book, Disaster Capitalism. And Jared Kushner is a classic disaster capitalist, like Peter Singer, if people have come across him. There's plenty of them. Christian Oddi in this country is shorting the pound, even though he's 100% Brexiteer, because that's the way to make money, isn't it?
So let's also have a look at another, I think, big story this week, which is the UN. We got some speeches now from some of the, or clips from them, from some of the world leaders. I've seen very little coverage of this, Martin. Again, I suppose because it's maybe because it's on Zoom. Tensions between the US and China, though, came to the fore at the annual UN General Assembly. They say in New York, but it's not really in New York, it's virtual, with US President Donald Trump blaming China for the spread of coronavirus. He called for China to be held accountable, as he put it, for the pandemic. Chinese President Xi Jinping said his country had no intention to enter a Cold War with any country. So Donald Trump is trying to, I think, egg it up a little bit, this battle. And let's have a listen to him anyway, and we'll hear afterwards from Xi, and also finally from Vladimir Putin, who also had some interesting things to say at the General Assembly, which has hardly been covered at all in the Western press, even though it's the 75th anniversary of the UN. Actually, Martin, I've changed my mind. Before we hear from Donald Trump, is the UN still a viable operation? Is it still serving a useful purpose after 75 years?
Well, the Chinese and the Russians are determined that the UN is going to carry on being the main mechanism through which disputes are resolved. It's the US in particular that doesn't want international law. What they want is, what's the phrase they use? A rules-based system. But they don't want international law. International law is a rules-based system, but they want a rules-based system which isn't international law. In other words, their law. Just no justice.
Well,
this
is why we've got the Assange case going on at the
moment.
Well,
indeed, that's a classic example of the US trying to use its own internal laws as if they were extraterritorial and apply to anybody on the planet at the same time as going on about international law. They're not members of the International Criminal Court. They're trying to prosecute and harass the International Criminal Court. They're not members. They're not signatories to the chemical weapons and biological weapons conventions, and they're not signatories to the law of the sea. But nevertheless, everybody else has got to obey the rules, but the US, because it's an exceptional country, doesn't have to obey the rules, and that's in everybody's interest because they're so wise and good.
Actually, before we hear from Donald Trump, let's hear about someone much more important. His name is Julian Assange, and he's been taken back to Belmarsh prison at the end of this week. I think they're trying to wind the hearing up in 4 weeks altogether, so that's by the end of next week. During the hearing, says your man in the public gallery, Craig Murray, day 17, during the hearing of medical evidence in the last 3 days, the British government has been caught twice directly telling important lies about events in Belmarsh prison, each lie proven by documentary evidence. The common factor has been the medical records kept by Dr. Daly, head of the jail's medical service. There's also been, to put it in its very lightest, one apparent misrepresentation by Mr. Daly. Personally, I'm very wary of the kind of person who impresses Ross Kemp. Mr. Kemp's description of the medical wing at Belmarsh: security is on another level here, with six times more staff per inmate than the rest of the jail. Whilst in the medical wing or health care, Julian Assange was in effect in solitary confinement. Three psychiatrists and a physician with extensive experience of treating trauma have all testified in court. Assange's mental and physical condition had deteriorated while he was in health care for several months. So what kind of doctors are these? Mengele doctors?
Well, I understand that he was being given psychotropic drugs, just as they used to do in Soviet mental hospitals.
Unfortunately, to do so, he must reveal, to explain these lies, says Craig Murray, details of Julian's medical condition, which I have withheld, but I think the situation is so serious that he believes that he has to do that. Professor Michael Koppelman gave evidence that, among other preparations for suicide, Julian Assange had hidden a razor blade in his folded underwear, but this had been discovered in a search of his cell. As I've reported, Koppelman was subjected to an extremely aggressive cross-examination by James Lewis, which in the morning had focused on the notion that Assange's mental illness was simply malingering and that Koppelman had failed to detect this. The razor blade was a key factor in Lewis's browbeating of Koppelman, and he attacked him on it again and again. Lewis stated that Koppelman relied on the razor blade story for his diagnosis. He then proceeded to portray it as a fantasy concocted by Assange to support his malingering. Lewis asked Koppelman repeatedly why. If the story was true, it was not in Dr. Daly's clinical notes. So there is apparently no evidence for a razor blade, and yet this is being talked about, that Julian Assange had hidden a razor blade and intended to kill himself, and therefore they had to feed him drugs.
Well, I've been trying to follow this trial. I mean, it's extraordinary, the evidence that's coming out. And it ought to be front page news, because it's one of the most... did you see this week, lots of senior political figures from all over the world have written a joint letter to the British saying you've got to release this guy now. So there was an article in The Guardian, of all places, from Luis Inácio da Silva, who of course is still under house arrest for supposed corruption in Brazil, saying that he's got to be released, and various other people also going along with this, you know. So there's, you know, it's beginning to be a cause célèbre. It's a bit like the Dreyfus case in France back in the 19th century. And ultimately, it's quite possible that he will be released. And we shall see what happens.
Apparently, there was a charge sheet. About a concealed razor blade. What Assange had told Koppelman and what Koppelman had believed was true in every single detail. In a scene straight out of a TV legal drama, during Koppelman's testimony, the defence had managed to obtain the charge sheet from Belmarsh Prison. Assange had been charged with the offence of the razor blade. The charge sheet is dated 0900 on the 7th of May 2019, and Craig Murray copies it here. So I'll put links up to that on our show page. It's not entirely clear to me as to whether this was real, or whether it was just concocted in order to give an excuse. But you can understand, actually, many warriors in World War II carried cyanide pills, Martin, didn't they?
That's right.
They believed that if they were captured, obviously Julian Assange doesn't want to spend the rest of his life in US custody.
No, he doesn't.
And he may be. He would have the courage to kill himself.
I put it to people listening to this show. How would you feel after years and years and years in solitary confinement? Would you be happy? He's lost loads of weight.
And
ultimately, he should be released. And, of course, he should get massive compensation.
So I'll put a link up to Your Man in the Public Gallery, Assange Hearing Day 17, the blog by Craig Murray on our show page at This Week. .org.uk, and we'll go straight to Zoom in Washington. Actually, no, it's New York, isn't it? To have a listen to Donald Trump this week at the United Nations 75th General Assembly.
We pioneered life-saving treatments, reducing our fatality rate 85% since April. Thanks to our efforts, three vaccines are in the final stage of clinical trials. We are mass-producing them in advance so they can be delivered immediately upon arrival. We will distribute a vaccine. We will defeat the virus. We will end the pandemic. And we will enter a new era of unprecedented prosperity, cooperation, and peace. As we pursue this bright future, we must hold accountable the nation which unleashed this plague onto the world. China. In the earliest days of the virus, China locked down travel domestically while allowing flights to leave China and infect the world. China condemned my travel ban on their country, even as they canceled domestic flights and locked citizens in their homes. The Chinese government and the World Health Organization, which is virtually controlled by China, falsely declared that there was no evidence of human-to-human transmission. Later, they falsely said people without symptoms would not spread the disease. The United Nations must hold China accountable for their actions. In addition, every year, China dumps millions and millions of tons of plastic and trash into the oceans, overfishes other countries' waters, destroys vast swaths of coral reef, and emits more toxic mercury into the atmosphere than any country anywhere in the world. China's carbon emissions are nearly twice what the U.S. has, and it's rising fast. By contrast, after I withdrew from the one-sided Paris Climate Accord, last year America reduced its carbon emissions by more than any country in the agreement. Those who attack America's exceptional environmental record while ignoring China's rampant pollution are not interested in the environment. They only want to punish America, and I will not stand for it. If the United Nations is to be an effective organization, it must focus on the real problems of the world.
So that's Donald Trump there, really just reading out a speech. But he's getting very, very belligerent about China, Martin. He's blaming them for the virus, which I suppose is kind of obvious. If his soldiers at the Wuhan military games had planted it there, he would be blaming it on them.
Well, interestingly enough, I read this week that the Hong Kong, she's Hong Kong-based, she's not actually a doctor, an epidemiologist, but she's been saying that she had evidence that it was a leak from Wuhan, it was a Chinese biological weapon, whatever. But she's been discredited by her own colleagues at Hong Kong University and said, well, she had nothing to do with it, and that she's just making it all up. But she, Steve Bannon was talking about her, I think, as being the insider that would blow open the fact that it was a Chinese biological weapon. But of course, he's under house arrest because of all this stuff that, for defrauding charity donations. But if the US wants to push, and the Murdoch press in Australia wants to push this idea that it's a biological weapon, that's a two-edged sword, because it possibly is a biological weapon, and if it is a biological weapon, it's the same people that carried out the 9/11 attacks.
I don't think they do want to push that. This is a China virus,
yes,
that's all.
Yeah.
But actually, are they saying they're sort of trying to hint that it might be a biological weapon, aren't they?
Some people in the Murdoch press and elsewhere are pushing the idea that it was a Chinese biological weapon. I'm willing to go there. If it is a biological weapon, it's probably something done by the deep state. Don't forget, we keep stressing this, the DIA, Defence Intelligence Agency, told the Israeli Defence Force,
Martin,
according to Times of Israel,
that it's
going to be a pandemic in China.
What's much more important than that is that we had Pentagon money in the Wuhan virology lab.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Maybe the Pentagon were in charge of this.
Yes, well, indeed. And in actual fact, it's extraordinary to imagine, but the Chinese have probably kicked themselves. Why did we allow the Pentagon to invest in our biological
lab? Well, it'll probably be one of these spiders like Henry Kissinger that has fingers in both camps, that persuades one university in China to have a load of stuff. They might be doing military stuff under civilian cover in China, and have these wonderful exchange programs. It's a bit like Gaddafi having an exchange program with Tony Blair, isn't it? He ends up having a coup against him and the West.
Well,
this is the trouble, isn't it? When you get somebody who's got fingers in both pies or in both camps, like Kissinger, and I really do suspect Kissinger is the sort of guy that would be sitting there trying very cleverly with the diplomats in China and the US to say, well, we've got to have some nice, sort of civilian program to kind of get things going. It only turns out that it ends up planting a bioweapon on them.
Yes, I mean, that's broadly what may have happened here. But I think the Chinese have probably realised they shouldn't be involved in joint enterprises with the Pentagon.
Isn't it what Putin said is the Americans are not deal ready, so let's not do deals with them.
Well, indeed, but of course the Chinese up to now have been playing the game of let's all cooperate together for the common good.
And they're continuing to do that this week at the UN General Assembly. And I'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Whatever your favourite country you're interested in, it might be Qatar, which is an interesting place. It might be UAE. Lots of interesting stuff going on there right now. It might be Turkey. And the Erdogan at the UN has been calling out China's treatment of Muslims in Kashmir. Very few people seem...
In Kashmir, all right.
Yeah, it's very few people seem to be talking about that anymore, even though it's almost like a year of turning that place into a prison camp. But anyway, let's have a listen now to President Xi and see how he replies to all these accusations from Donald Trump.
The virus will be defeated. Humanity will win this battle. Facing the virus, we should put people and life first. We should mobilize all resources to make a science-based and targeted response. No case should be missed, and no patient should be left untreated. The spread of the virus must be contained. Facing the virus, we should enhance solidarity and get this through together. We should follow the guidance of science, give full play to the leading role of the World Health Organization, and launch a joint international response to beat this pandemic. Any attempt of politicizing the issue or stigmatization must be rejected. Facing the virus, we should adopt comprehensive and long-term control measures. We should reopen businesses and schools in an orderly way so as to create jobs, boost the economy, and restore economic and social order and vitality. The major economies need to step up micro-policy coordination. We should not only restart our own economies, but also contribute to global recovery.
So that's, it's not actually President Xi, because he speaks in Chinese, but that's the translation of what he was saying yesterday or the day before at the UN General Assembly on Zoom, or some other system similar to Zoom, that they're using now on the 75th anniversary, Martin, of the United Nations.
Well, I mean, what he was basically saying there is fairly common sense stuff, rather than the rabble-rousing that we heard from the US president previously.
What do you make of the way that the UN operates, though? We've got these two main organisations, the Security Council and the General Assembly. This is the big bash for the General Assembly, isn't it? Where they get together in September every year. They actually haven't got together, but it does give all of the world leaders a chance to give a speech and, you know, to put forward what their views are. And like I say, I'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to the UN's YouTube channel, where you can pick up all this stuff and have a look, see what they're saying, because we're not getting anything really much from the mass media at all, picking up bits of interesting speeches. Martin?
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of people, it's a very abstract thing, the UN General Assembly, what the hell's that? Especially in the West, you know, they've got plenty of things to think about, like what's happening on EastEnders and when the football coming back.
No, I'm talking about political reporters. I mean, this is actually quite an important event in the world, and I was very shocked to see just no coverage of it. Well, except Trump. There was a bit of a clip of Trump.
Yeah.
That was it.
I mean, well, that's, you know.
It's not as if Trump
we're,
is.
We're only
is,
really interested in ourselves, aren't we?
Trump is not leader of the world, is he? We've got all sorts of other interesting people saying interesting stuff.
Well, indeed. But we don't get any genuine reporting of what the Chinese or the Russians are saying, do we?
We won't hear what Russia is saying, evil Putin is saying.
Well,
you will.
Right.
You will on this programme, because what he's done is he started off talking about the Security Council. He wants some changes in the way it operates. He believes that maybe it's getting a little bit past its sell-by date. He's not saying that it's not a useful institution. He's saying it's very useful, but that there could potentially be some tweaking. And also, he's very concerned about the economic impact of the virus.
Our thinking is that the Security Council should be more inclusive of the interests of all countries, as well as the diversity of their positions, base its work on the principle of the broadest possible consensus among states, and, at the same time, continue to serve as the cornerstone of global governance, which cannot be achieved unless the permanent members of the Security Council retain their veto power. Such a right pertaining to the five nuclear powers, the victors of the Second World War, remains indicative of the actual military and political balance to this day. Most importantly, it is an essential and unique instrument that helps prevent unilateral actions that may result in a direct military confrontation between major states, and provides an opportunity to seek compromise or at least avoid solutions that would be completely unacceptable to others and act within the framework of international law rather than a vague grey area of arbitrariness and illegitimacy. As diplomatic practice shows, this instrument actually works, unlike the infamous pre-war League of Nations, with its endless discussions, declarations without mechanisms for real action, and with states and peoples in need not having the right to assistance and protection. Forgetting the lessons of history is short-sighted and extremely irresponsible, just like the politicized attempt to arbitrarily interpret the causes, course, and outcomes of the Second World War, and twist the decisions of the conferences of the Allies and the Nuremberg Tribunal that are based on speculation instead of facts. It is not just vile and offensive to the memories of the victims, the fighters against Nazism. It is a direct and devastating blow to the very foundation of the post-war world order, which is particularly dangerous in view of the global stability facing serious challenges. The arms control system breaking down, regional conflicts continuing unabated, and threats posed by terrorism, organized crime, and drug trafficking intensifying. We are also experiencing a whole new challenge of the coronavirus pandemic. This disease has directly affected millions of people and claimed the most important thing, the lives of hundreds of thousands of people. Quarantines, border closures, numerous serious troubles to the citizens of almost all states constitute the present-day realia. It has been especially difficult for elderly people who, due to the necessary restrictions, have not been able to hug their loved ones, children and grandchildren, for weeks or even months. Experts are yet to fully assess the scale of the social and economic outlook caused by the pandemic and all its long-term consequences. However, it is already evident that it will take a really, really long time to restore the global economy.
A very, very long time to restore the global economy. Martin, maybe the global economy is now shot. It's just a question of a ticking time bomb.
Pretty much. But of course, both Xi and Putin are trying to argue in favour of, you know, a modified UN system, which, of course, the with what's happened over the Iran deal, for example, the US seems to be saying, well, we're just not interested in that old-fashioned balanced system.
I guess what
we want a unipolar system.
I guess what they're saying is that by trying to get round the UN Security Council system, the US is kind of making itself an international pariah.
Well, it is making itself an
international pariah. They didn't actually say that, but it's really between the lines. That's what they're suggesting.
Well, I think what's beginning to happen, don't forget, is, for example, the US withdrew from the World Health Organization. They're not in part of the International Criminal Court. They haven't ratified the Chemical and Biological Weapons Conventions. Basically, all the serious stuff. They've ripped up the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. Basically, they are ignoring all of the agreements that have been made over the last 30 years.
Isn't it becoming like the United States and Britain and possibly Israel too against the whole of the rest of the world?
Pretty much. And of course,
except for Saudi Arabia, maybe. Saudi
Arabia is part of that evil alliance. Not that they have, you know, this is part of the hypocrisy of the West going on about human rights, etc.
I mean, Putin's in
and
quite
it's all based on working with the Saudis.
Putin's in quite a strong position, though, isn't he, as a sort of swing state between China and US.
Yeah, well, what's actually happening in international relations is that China and Russia, who've actually got quite a lot of, you know, difficulties in their relationship, are being forced to cooperate because of the basically unacceptable attitude of the Americans. And Kissinger, for one, is not very happy about it. His policy was always to try and use one the Chinese against the Russians or vice versa. But you've got such arrogance inside the ruling elite in the West that they think that they can pick on them both simultaneously and that they won't gang up on them. And of course, once these infrastructures have been created so that the Chinese have access to all of the raw materials in Siberia and that the Chinese then invest heavily in the Russian economy, they are trying to build on the world island, as Mackinder called it, an economic powerhouse which will basically leave the West for dead.
Well, let's see what happens with the Great Reset, because that may be part of all of that. And what do you think? Or not?
Well, the Great Reset and the crashing of the Western financial markets is in order to try and make sure that China and Russia do not fulfil their potential economically. That's what it's all about. And of course, the West.
So
can
if,
only,
we can't
only,
if we can't control you, we'll ruin you.
Yeah, that's right. If you know, it's a dog in the manger approach. If we can't control it, you're not gonna. You can't have it.
So the World Economic Forum's techno-totalitarian roadmap. That's in Technocracy News. It's a few months ago this, but Klaus Schwab, president of the World Economic Forum, and UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres signed a partnership between the two organizations. This was done without any direct media attention, despite tremendous implications this poses to humanity. By and large, this means that the power over our lives with the stroke of a pen has been transferred to the big global corporations and their owners. The agreement, this article says, and I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk as usual. That is the article. Is headline is World Economic Forum's Techno-Totalitarian Roadmap. The agreement includes six focus areas: funding for the UN Agenda 2030, climate change, health, digital collaboration, gender equality, women's lib, and education and skills development. Now, it does sound as if there is this kind of economic policy developing between the World Economic Forum and the UN, Martin, which is likely to steer policy around the world. At least that's the idea. Part of this great reset is to start steering policy on an international level with the World Economic Forum in the driving seat.
Well, there is going to be big changes whatever now. I mean, we're definitely in the period of where there is going to be dramatic social and political changes. The question is, who's going to be in the driving seat, and where are we going?
I'll tell you who's going to be in the driving seat. It's Klaus Schwab. He's the founder of the World Economic Forum.
Yes, I know, but he's a spokesperson for other forces. Yeah. He's basically a
well, he may have somebody pulling his strings, but he's still sitting there in the driving seat. Anyway, so
the West has got its own vision of what should happen. And of course, the Chinese and the Russians have got a counter.
And he's got a bit of a negative message. He sounds a bit like you here, Martin. He's talking recently about he thinks everyone's going to get a lot more angry in the next few months. Would you agree with that?
That's possibly, it's like a global strategy of tension, a global gladio. Isn't it?
Well, in what way? What do you mean by that?
Well, the banking system started collapsing in September last year, and BlackRock, who are basically a hedge fund, have been given full control of US economic policy, which means full control of global economic policy. And that's already happened. And there's going to be a crash now. And as you say, the clever people will have all the money stashed away, so they're going to buy everything up for pennies on the dollar.
It's a kind of privatization as well, though, isn't it?
Well, of course it is. It's a way. If the great reset in the mind of the oligarchs is to put them firmly in the driving seat. But the great reset could be, if the Chinese communists stick to their communist values, etc., is that the oligarchs are the ones who are put in the dustbin of history.
Well, let's have a listen now, anyway, to the guy who's going to be in charge of it. I think almost we should be looking at what these folk are up to every week, really, here. Klaus Schwab here talking about, in a kind of threatening way, rather like Henry Kissinger was a few months ago in the middle of the pandemic, talking about, well, you know, unless you sort out a global response to this, and people like David Miliband were even put forward as the people who should be leading that global response, then the world will be catching on fire. Now, he's saying a similar thing here, Klaus Schwab is, as the president of the World Economic Forum, about the Great Reset. We must prepare for an angrier world, he says.
What we know is that we will end up with many more unemployed, and particularly also people in the grey economy, which are not counted for, who lose their jobs. So we will see definitively a lot of anger already now, but probably increased by the end of the year, because this crisis will be with us until we really have found a remedy. So we have to prepare for a more angry world. And how to prepare? It means to take the necessary action to create a fairer world, to see that we provide everybody with decent access to the health system, that we make sure that those people who are really left behind, and I'm not speaking only on national levels, I'm speaking also internationally. If I see now the tragedy in some of the emerging countries like South Africa, like some countries in East Asia, I think it's all, I don't have too many remedies. The remedies have to be discussed through dialogue by the stakeholders of our global system. But I just see the need for such a dialogue, and I see the need for action. I see the need for a great reset.
Well, here he is selling his great reset. Would you buy a used car from Klaus Schwab, Martin?
Well, at the end of the day, all he's saying is motherhood and apple pie. Wouldn't it be nice if people had access to healthcare? Yes, it would. Now, which country...
He represents some of the people that control most of the wealth in the world.
Yes, so in other words, he's saying us wealthy people, we care too. Of course we do.
And he's saying it's going to go from an angry world to a fairer world. Do you trust him?
Well, if an angry world goes to a fairer world via what Mao Zedong would call a revolution. And, of course, the Chinese are building a fairer world, but it's on the back of millions of Chinese who died in their revolution. And I'm afraid that the world doesn't change necessarily through posh, wealthy people like Klaus Schwab starting to talk as if they cared. That really is by the by. When the real movement starts happening, we will see, as the Chinese say, when the two rice bowls clash, we will see which one is fuller.
Finishing this week with David Livingstone again. Before we hear from him, Martin, I'll just ask you a little bit about this, because he's putting the jigsaw together, looking at links between the British spy Jamal Afghani and the Islamic terror groups like the Salafists today. He's saying basically that the British, during the early days of empire and middle, sort of in the 1800s of empire, were deliberately going around seeding these sorts of alternative movements to Islam. Do you think does it really go back that far or not?
No, not in my view. If you want a straightforward answer.
Okay, well, let's have a listen to what he's saying here. Eventually, that this tradition led to some of the individuals that were behind things like Operation Gladio. So let's see. He's going to try and join the dots. Let's see if Martin, after we've heard from David Livingstone, whether you agree with him or not.
So what Jamal Afghani tried to say was that the reason why Islam was falling behind the West was because the doors of jihad had been closed. So he called for...
Actually, I've read those writings by Jamaluddin Afghani myself.
Right. So he was a British agent?
Yes. Okay.
He was a British agent, both him and Muhammad Abdu. Muhammad Abdu in particular was in direct contact with Lord Cromer. Jamal Afghani was in contact with Scowen Blunt. I think it was Edward Scowen Blunt? Wilfred Scowen Blunt. And so what their goal was to create a neo-caliphate. And so they were also in contact with Abdul Qadir al-Jazairi, who's another important character I'll mention, who was also Grand Master of the Freemasons, despite the fact that he's very famous. He was also involved with the Shadidli Sufi order. They all were. That's a very important tradition to follow, but we'll get to that point. And So what Afghani's point was to call for a reopening of the doors of Ijtihad to be able to rewrite Islam, which is what they've done. Right? So that's the point of Salafism. The point of Salafism is basically to undermine the Madhab tradition and to create a British version of Islam that would allow them to write a new version that was adaptable to British colonialism. So Jamal Afghani is a notorious, intriguer, subverter. So what he does now is he poses as a guy named Haji Sharif, who claims to be an Afghan prince. And who does he make contact with? He makes contact with a guy named Alexandre Saint-Yves Dalvendre. And why he's important is Dalvendre, it becomes the founder of what's called Synarchism.
Hmm.
And Synarchism claims to be the political system that was adopted by the inhabitants of a civilization in the hollow earth called Agartha.
Hmm.
And it's very closely related to a similar concept taught by Blavatsky called Shambhala. Both of them are supposedly located in, somewhere around Tibet, and to preserve basically the ancient teachings of the Aryans. So Synarchism becomes the underlying occult ideology of 20th century fascism.
Mm.
So Jamal Afghani is responsible for three trajectories, actually. theosophy through Elena Blavatsky and ultimately leading to the New Age movement, through Salafism, which then becomes adopted by the Saudi state, who were installed by the British and supported by Rockefeller Oil. And then thirdly, Sinarchism, which becomes, this is what I detail in Black Terror White Soldiers. Sinarchism is a occult tradition which is not recognized by a lot of researchers, especially Muslims. But that is this is what I expose. That is the key to the relationship between the Western Masons and the Muslim Brotherhood. So, you know, I mean, that's the point. That's a separate trajectory. So basically the Muslim Brotherhood becomes the organization that was, first of all, it was commissioned by Hitler, who commissioned Hassan al-Banna to create the organization. They first were in the employ of the Germans. When the Germans lost the war, then it got taken over by the CIA, but they continued to use neo-Nazis to coordinate with them. So that's why you find that right up until very recently, the Muslim Brotherhood had extensive relationships with neo-Nazis, particularly François Genoux. So François Genoux is very important because he's considered to be the guy who's in charge of the Nazi gold, basically the treasure, the bulk of the assets, of post-war assets of Nazis. And another guy named Ahmed Huber, who was part of what's called Avalon Gesellschaft. So now there's too many points to discuss. I can't get into the point.
We have more than one session, but yeah. Alhamdulillah, Allah has blessed you with tremendous amount of information and knowledge, and even you have been able to connect all this to Islam.
The most important exponent of Sinarchism in our time is a guy named Alexander Dugin. So out of Sinarchy, the most important basically developer of the tradition of Sinarchism is a guy named François René Guénon. And so René Guénon created a tradition of what's now called traditionalism. The next follower after him is a guy named Giulio Savola, who is an Italian fascist philosopher. He's the guy who was the main ideologue behind the Gladio operation, which is a CIA operation. And so today, that guy is a guy named Alexander Dugin.
So there's lots and lots of dots he's joining there, Martin. But, you know, this does sound, if there's an air of credibility to this to me, the British Empire obviously realised that, you know, that Muslims, it was much better if you could control some, to a certain extent, Islam, not allowing them to go their own way, but to set up kind of fake versions of Islam, which were actually secretly run by the British. And this intelligence officer, he says, was an intelligence officer called Jamal Afghani, eventually leading, he says, there to the people who created the Gladio networks. And those, of course, were used, have been used in what Sybil Edmonds would describe as Gladio B, in order to set up Muslims. So what do you make of that? Do you think he would be laughed out of court if he was giving a lecture at Oxford?
I think there'd be lots of professional historians who would dispute aspects of what he's saying there. For example, I'll just pick up one thing. The Muslim Brotherhood was started by the British in Egypt as a means of undermining secular nationalists. So they weren't started by the Nazis at all. And they've been, actually, the Muslim Brotherhood is seen around the world as basically a British or now US cat's paw, and has been for many years. The Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia were put in power by the British. You remember Lawrence of Arabia and all the rest of it. And so we've created this, and don't forget, in the 1980s, Operation, what was it called? Operation Cyclone was the biggest undercover operation in history, paid for by your taxes, British listeners, to train the Salafist terrorists from Saudi Arabia and elsewhere to kill Russian soldiers in Afghanistan. And then, we are told, they turned on their masters and carried out 9/11, even though we're still providing them with weaponry and training to try and overthrow the government of Syria as we speak. Now, in actual fact, extremist Salafist Islam has always been in the pocket of the Western imperialists. And that's why they're deadly enemies of the Iranians, and we are on their side.
So as its influence grew, the Muslim Brotherhood opposed British rule in Egypt. So that does suggest that maybe it wasn't the British.
No, they opposed British rule in Egypt. But it's a bit like Hamas.
It's a counter gang.
It's a counter gang, yes, to use Frank Kitson's term. And Hamas was originally created by Israeli intelligence to undermine the PLO. And what the sort of Rhodes Circle people in Western imperialism tried to do, they tried to encourage the most extreme and reactionary forms of Islam as a means of undermining what they regarded at that time as their main enemies, which were secular nationalists like Nasser, etc.
But I mean, isn't it possible, even if the British created it, that the Nazis would want to infiltrate it and use it as a cat's paw to bash the British in Egypt?
Well, yes, indeed. And everybody tries to infiltrate everybody else and tries to steer things in the direction they want them to go. That is true. But of course, the Germans were very late appearers on the international imperialist scene. Not least because they lost the First World War and were kicked out of all their colonies and so on. So it's basically the British, and then followed by them the Americans, who created the State of Israel and the State of Saudi Arabia, which are, you know, which are now, of course, pretty much closely allied with the West, destroying Yemen as we speak and creating misery, untold misery across the planet.
How's it going to end then, do you think?
Well,
you're going to tell me badly, aren't you?
Well, yes, I'm afraid so. People are going to have to face up to the fact, as they did in previous generations, that the people in charge are not just incompetent, they're evil, and their goals are evil, and there's going to have to be huge sacrifices, I'm afraid.
I'll just finish on one news story, which is one of the main stories today, about the killing of a policeman in Croydon. I can remember being told by Ian Matteson, who was a former Freemason, who died a couple of months ago, that Croydon had the worst reputation amongst the Freemasons anywhere in the country. So the Freemasons had been there, the lodges in Croydon had been working for many, many decades to just give themselves planning permission, make money like that. And so it might simply be that Croydon is not a very good place to be, simply because of the criminal fraternity being rather too close to law enforcement. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest in the first hour and in the second hour. That is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page, and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.